Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by AOL Radio at AOL.com/podcasting. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 195 for May 18th, 2009, a series of tube tops. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get two free books. Go to audible.com/twit2 and follow Audible on Twitter. User ID audible_com. And by GoToMeeting. Do more and travel less with GoToMeeting. Make your next meeting a GoToMeeting instead. For your free 30-day trial, visit gotomeeting.com/twit. And by squarespace.com. The fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account, go to squarespace.com/twit. Hi, this is Leo Laporte. Before we begin the show, a program note. I had a great interview with Stephen Wolfram, the creator of Wolfram Alpha, on Saturday, right about when they were launching the product. He talked about how Wolfram Alpha was created, what its point is, how it works. I think it was very interesting. It's about a half-hour interview, and I decided to stick it at the end of this podcast. So we're about to begin TWiT. I hope you'll enjoy it. And then stick around afterwards for a special half-hour interview with Stephen Wolfram. Thanks. This is TWiT, episode 195, and we're gathered around on a very hot Petaluma afternoon in studio. Everybody's sweltering, sweating. And I think this is going to mean a particularly interesting TWiT as people try to rush through the stories and get out of here or take off their clothes. Starting with John C. Dvorak.
Wouldn't
already
be something
in a bikini.
You really want to see.
In the Speedo. He's doing the Borat.
You know, the joke of it is I am wearing Speedos.
Underneath?
Wow.
Underneath your pants? Go ahead. Let's see.
Mayday.
Wow.
Oh, there's Speedo shoes.
Can't they check? Oh.
There's Speedo shoes. That's just a blatant ripoff of what I'm wearing.
So you can say you saw Dvorak wearing Speedos. No, those are that's some sort of
oh my
rubber.
God!
These are Crocs.
Oh, Crocs! These are like a croc of Crocs. These are phony.
They're phony Crocs. That's what I'm saying. It's a complete and utter ripoff.
Wow!
The Crocs are crap anyway. These rubber shoes are
rubber loose. Shoes are rubber shoes. Mario Battaglia says you can put these in the dishwasher.
But you can say I was wearing Speedos.
I really thought you wanted me to look down your pant leg. I was kind of
horrified. Well, yeah, you were hoping. You were hoping.
I was pretty glad that the pant went up that way.
But it's funny
and not
that
this way.
No, it's well, hey, I'm not Steve Jobs, okay?
You could tell the party's already begun. To my left, Becky Worley of ABC News. To my right, Molly Wood of CBS Interactive. We've got a distinguished party here.
You know what I was thinking about this on the way up? This is mixed doubles.
Mixed doubles.
You're right.
Because, and not only is it mixed doubles, but it's a really good pairing because Leo and I are both sort of perky, bright side of life kind of people. And Molly has a great ability to rant but stay very likable about it. Hmm. And Dvorak is king of curmudgeon. So really, you could do perky with sort of curmudgeon-y either way, boy, girl, or girls on boys.
It's so interesting because, in fact, I have a list, a notebook that I do to prepare the shows and to put together the cast, and you're listed under perky.
I knew that.
She's listed under rant but nice. And John is listed under...
You don't have any of that.
Look
in there.
At that binder.
This is some binder.
That is so organized.
Out.
Oh, it's upside down. Wait
oh.
He has an algorithm for mixing and matching.
I actually do.
A combination of rage and friendliness.
Who can get to come in? Yeah.
Not so. It's really very much of a it is a cooking show. It's a recipe. I always plan the show out very carefully. What?
I listened to last week. Sorry.
She's worked with you too long.
That makes me feel actually even more guilty for how often I say no.
So let's get to the
You know
news.
What I do?
I want to.
You know what I do? I build the show around you. If you can't show up, I change. You know, I know where I'm. You're the starting point.
Well, that's helping. I feel less
You're the
guilty
starting
now.
Point.
John is impatient already.
Let's go.
Yeah,
come
yeah.
On.
It is about 1,000 degrees in here.
The people, they have me on the show, that these guys in this chat rooms to move things along.
Right. Well, what's important?
Wolfram Alpha launches. That's the number one story. They started on Friday. Today's the weekend they launched. I talked to Stephen Wolfram yesterday. I had a good long interview with him. So what do you think of Wolfram
Alpha? Why don't you back out? Because I've seen it. I get the general gist. But going into this story, I had no idea what the heck this was about. So can somebody do this summation?
Thumbnail. Stephen Wolfram is a physicist by training. He went to Caltech, got his PhD in physics at Caltech at the age of 20. At the age of 22, won the MacArthur Grant, the youngest recipient ever of the Genius Prize. He became very interested in computational physics and really became a computer whiz and believes that computers can be used to solve physics problems, to discover new physical theorems. In fact, he's gone so far now, he's written a science book, 1,200-page kind of manifesto about physics, in which he says, you know, I think that computational physics is the future, and the idea is to write every possible program, and you'll find in every possible program you'll learn all sorts of new things. He created a program called Mathematica. It's a $2,000 program. It's used by mathematicians, mathematics students. Very popular. It's been around for 20 years.
Yeah.
Have you used, do you know anything about Mathematica, John?
I think I may have been the first guy to plug it.
You discovered it?
I think so. This is when I was, I think this was at InfoWorld or something.
It was very innovative. Still is. It's a notebook format. You can, it's free form. You write equations. It'll graph them. Into, it's very, and it has its own symbolic language.
Yeah.
And that's kind of key, because what he then did was, and this was 5 years ago, did it completely stealthily. He said, we're going to try to create a computational engine for the internet based on this symbolic language in Mathematica that will allow people to essentially compute anything. Solve any problem by taking arbitrary data sets and asking questions about those data sets. He's been doing this for 5 years. It only became public a few months ago. I asked him why stealth. He said, because I don't know if it would work or not. He said it couldn't even work until very recently. You didn't have the computational power to make this happen. So he went online this weekend. It looks on the surface of it, and I think this is a problem for him, at like Google.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like a search engine. It ain't a search engine. That's not. You're supposed to enter in. I mean, I'm not clear on how to use it.
Well, it's a little bit baffling. Yeah, there was kind of a great headline in PC World, actually, about it that just said, I am not smart enough for Wolfram Alpha. And that's kind of how I feel. Like, one thing, I can barely say it without saying Wolfram Alpha.
Alpha.
It's
kind of hard to say.
You can't
annoying.
Say it.
So
I just,
if they could change the name,
been
that
saying
would be
Wolfgang
super.
Puck.
Right,
much
right. I am not smart enough for Wolfgang Puck. Like, I went there and I just tried to enter something and nothing happened.
Me too.
Well, but luckily he has a few, there are suggestions on the side, like things to enter. And then if you enter all those.
You enter San Francisco and you get a whole bunch of stuff.
And so then is that right,
yeah,
remotely
but it's,
useful?
But that's
what's
trivial
really
use
cool.
Of it.
No, I know, but it's a very handy use if you're a talk show host.
Yes, that's true.
What it basically does is if you enter a query that it has the right kind of data set for, it spits out a report. I mean, you get graphs and you get stats and you get...
And you can make a PDF of it and put it in somebody's binder, and the next thing you know, you look like a genius.
Yeah, it's basically just homework done.
Hmm.
It's, you know, he said, I asked him, and he said, I said, do you ever get any surprising results? He said, oh, every time I use it, I get unusual results. He says, for instance, if you put in a first name, one of the things you'll see, it plots first names against when they were used and so forth. He says, I can give you your life expectancy based on your first name statistically, because Molly was only used, you know, in these years, and the chances are you're a certain age. And so it has life expectancy information. It has, you know, it's combining databases, information databases, in unusual ways. It uses Mathematica underlying. He says every query is converted to a symbolic mathematical query. It's very heavy, dude.
Anyway, so people should check it out.
It seems, just from looking at it before the show,
but it's not Google.
Totally non sequitur. I mean, it just seems so random,
it is, yeah.
And you just have to wonder if expectations being high, people.
Well,
being
I think
confused.
The problem is that people immediately confuse it with Google, and they call it a search engine. It's neither. It's not a competitor to Google. In fact, they have a Google link on it, and it's not a search engine by any means.
Well, yeah, it's very hard to classify.
It's just something else.
And it's a little bit hard to determine what you're going to get. What it is basically just wonderful information gathering and kind of extreme geekery. I don't think that, you know, in terms of the rest of the world, they're going to be talking about Wolfram Alpha nearly as much as we are. And they're not going to be talking about
not.
It at all, because it's freaking impossible to say. But I think it is almost just like fun data mining. Like, it's fun. I put my name in. Turns out there's only 124,956 people alive today named Molly.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah. Right? It's
this
just
is
neat.
Yet another time sink.
It's yeah, he
that's
said,
exactly what
the other thing he said
it's
is
a neat little
so
rabbit hole is what it
know
is.
That.
There's a learning curve. And he said that as people use it, they he's watched even over the last 48 hours, and people have been asking better and better questions. So I think that some of it is that. I asked him, what's your goal for this in 5 or 10 years? He said, eventually I want this to be, you can ask a question and it will anything that's computational, it will be able to solve. Just kind of a universal computational engine.
Isn't that Ask Jeeves' goal?
No, well, no, Ask Jeeves was to do regular searches using a standard language query.
Right, but it was still a search engine. So the difference is Google or Ask Jeeves is only searching what somebody has already answered and put on the net.
Yeah, but in his
this
own
creates
fact,
new
he
answers.
Says you have to ask something that's already known. He says that in his own fact.
But then he draws these
known
relational...
Known doesn't mean on the net.
Right, he draws these sort of relational connections, right? He makes relationships. What the engine does is make relationships between data and spit out other knowledge, basically. Like, it sort of adds to the body of knowledge about something that's already known, I guess.
Is this just worship of a guy who happens to be obscenely smart, who is pandering
like
to humanity?
She's skeptical one here. And just,
oh, no. I'm supposed to be perky.
I think that she was perky.
I think that's exactly... Oh, that's the question, though. You look at that's something like this, and either the guy is a crackpot or he's a genius, and I can't figure it out.
I think it's the death of thought, this thing. Because really, if you think about it, this is the kind of thing that means that in the future, you don't actually have to know anything yourself. And you don't have to do any of your own kind of drawing of relationships between the data in your head and the data that you find.
It's not going to replace
it. You just plug it all in here,
work like that.
And then boom, it tells you things.
I don't think it's going to replace thought. In fact, I think the idea is you think most of the thought is asking the right query and then finding out interesting relationships. Yeah. Well, I don't know. You know, I
like that you very seriously said, I don't think this is going to replace thought. I don't know.
Hey, I listen to you and I pay attention to what you say.
I'm full of it.
I have to say, I just honor the guy because it takes a grandiose vision, which this clearly is, to make any progress. Unless you say, man can fly, and we're going to figure out how, or maybe it's possible to make a machine and a website that could solve every problem, you don't try these things. So I admire him. I mean, it's a gutsy thing to do.
I just put in the query, got an I'm sorry, Dave message.
Yeah, they're really overburdened right now.
Of course, everyone that's been listening to us is
going
there. Now they're
slamming.
In all honesty, though, I think that this is phenomenal. I think that the way that... Search was the first great frontier in terms of breaking down all of the world's information is accessible at our fingertips. And the categorization and the discovery of that information.
I think it's a myth.
And then the relationships between all of those different data sets are kind of the key to accessing any of this, to have it, making
it
accessible.
It's a great myth.
Well, it's
all of the world's information is not at our fingertips.
It is now with Wolfram.
No, it's just a bunch of some information.
More and more. And the computer, what's changed is the computer.
Most.
Yeah, that's nice.
What's the...
What's changed is the computers give you the ability to process this. You know, in the past, you could put everything online, but who could find anything? Now you have the capability of finding it, and then the next step is to make some sense out of it. I think this is the next step, and I think it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. I hope he succeeds.
Yeah. I hope he
but meanwhile...
He's already succeeded.
Meanwhile, on Twitter...
Thank goodness.
Wow. Whoever
Thank goodness. Finally
that
a topic
to
that's interesting.
Something else
Twitter.
Twitter. Wow.
I got nothing
diggity.
To say about Twitter.
Good.
We'll do all the Twitter stories. We have a new way of doing Twitter. I do all the Twitter stories at the very end of the show, and I tell people, we're going to do Twitter now. You know, somebody wrote a program to take Twitter out of Twit. So it analyzes the show. It's a Python program. Analyzes the show. And if the word Twitter is in the sentence, it takes the sentence out. And it also could be used the other way, where you take everything but Twitter out. So
who
you get your choice.
I'd like the guy who did that. I wanted to hear from him.
He's brilliant, isn't he?
Yeah.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, I'm serious. I want that guy
to
get a hold of me.
He did it because of you. You know that,
JohnDvorak.org.
You created that need. there's actually a lot of stories, and we're going to get through them fast. Netbook demand dropped 26% in the first quarter. Remember we were saying netbooks are the next big thing? Apparently not.
I think that the sales over Christmas were
I'm sorry,
so insane.
I can't think. What?
I know.
Would you just put some bourbon in his slushie?
I know, for God's sake, man.
For God's sake, give him something else to slurp at.
Demand for that slurping sound has decreased 100% in the last 10 minutes.
Look it up on Wolfram.
Oh, no.
This is according to Market Watcher Display Search, and they base this on display demand. 5.9 million netbooks shipped worldwide first quarter, down 26% from the 8 million in Q4. Now, there's two possibilities. One is they're a netbook is too expensive in the modern economy. People can't even afford those. Or people got them and realized, now, Molly Wood's using the Vivian Tam Dell Mini now.
Yes, the HP Mini.
HP Mini.
I see.
Yeah.
Ooh, it's pretty.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if people are discovering.
Mayday.
I wonder if people are discovering that they're not powerful enough. But
I don't think that it's about reacting to the netbooks themselves. I mean, I think that you hit a market really well. They saw the price point, they jumped on it, and then those that had need have been saturated with them.
And
I think this
saturated.
Is good news for hardware manufacturers.
Isn't it beautiful?
Yeah. It's gorgeous.
Yeah. I absolutely love it.
So did you see the Acer story? Acer shipments of netbooks up 300%, profits down 30%.
Well, that's a problem for Intel, too, because the Atom is not a very profitable processor. Intel's not so happy about all this.
So
how come their profits are down? Acer's profits are down.
I think there's zero margin on these netbooks. And I think that they actually lost market share on some of their other books that have higher profit margin because they were selling
did
netbooks.
Did you see the Seashell? You're going to want one of these, Molly. It's going to replace your Vivian Tam. The new Acer EPC.
If it's
EPC.
Pretty, I'm in.
It's thin.
Have you been to Della.com?
No.
Oh, let's talk about
Hello.
Della. It's selling Della. Selling Dell computers to gals.
To the ladies.
The ladies.
Oh, see, now this is the kind of thing that frequently makes me angry. Actually, that redirected to weddingchannel.com.
It's actually Dell. You have Della. To go through Dell's website. It's not Della.com. Apologies.
So the idea, in fact, I love the headline. I can't remember who said it. It's selling computers the 1959 style. It's really
I don't know.
A ladies.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see if I can find this.
I think this is good
I'm
because
have
Molly
to go dig up my old MicroTimes column. I wrote a series of columns in MicroTimes way back when discussing the likelihood of something like this actually emerging, and then I got a bunch of great hate mail.
Well,
at one point I went very far in terms of building out the idea of an electronic store that would appeal to women, mm-hmm. as opposed to the electronic stores we have now, which make me want to die.
Well, there's lots of pictures
as soon as you walk in
of women on the front of it.
This is really pretty pandery. I'm not going to lie.
Where is it?
Like as the woman who bought the HP Mini Vivian Tam Edition laptop, this is a little too far.
Google Della. It's the fourth one down.
Well, it's interesting because I think that the perception is that this is some sort of a site that looks like a Massengill ad. Like, if you need to feel fresh, here's the nice pink.
Oh, Google. Sorry.
Right.
But it's not that.
My computer is not so fresh feeling.
Yeah. But it's not that. And I think in some senses, this is a natural to slam it because it does feel like it's pandering to women. But on the other side of the coin,
it is kind of nice.
It's
pretty.
It's
you're the one who bought the
frickin'
Vivian Tam.
Differently. It's
right.
not.
Right.
It's not saying, you know, because your purse is so heavy.
But
it
you know
just
what
shows
it is
pictures
doing?
Of women as opposed to dudes.
But it has products, tech tips, and featured artists.
Features artists. Cause,
like
mean, featured artists,
it's
right.
sort of like don't mix the content up, right? Like I actually really like that this is an attractive, nicely designed site that has products that are good looking and reasonably priced or, you know, whatever, maybe
Robin
powerful
Marino.
Enough. And,
that's
fine.
It's a fashion expert.
But once
it's a
you
lifestyle
start,
person.
Yeah, like why do you have to throw in this weird little lifestyle stuff? Like, what's giving? Like, why is there a link that says giving and then there's a featured
because
artist?
Because women want to give.
Like, just because I'm a woman doesn't mean I want to give and doesn't mean I care about art.
Women
I like
me
computers.
A netbook.
But you know, I mean, why did you get the Vivian Tam edition?
Because it's gorgeous. The fact is, if you do beautiful right, then you don't have to pander to me. You just do gorgeous, and then I'm in, you know?
I just would never pay more for it, though. That's
oh, I paid
part.
A lot more for it.
You
it's very
more?
Embarrassing.
So,
oh, there's a huge fashion tax on the Vivian Tam.
Why don't you just get a cheap-ass decal and put it on there?
I don't know. I just fell in
no,
love.
No, no, no.
Sometimes
and I think,
that happens.
I think this is
look
exactly...
like Leo's Twit TV thing. Can you get a shot of that?
No, I can't get a
but
shot
know,
of that.
But, you know, dudes will pay a lot more for a Sony computer just because they respect the Sony name, and it's like Gucci to them.
What?
Yeah, not
what,
you.
What planet are you from that
not
anyone respects
you.
The Sony name?
I'm talking about your average Joe who thinks Sony is some Bologna. Sort of a high-end electronics brand. And they will buy a Sony laptop because it says Sony. Sony, and it looks a little
schnazzier. Well, I'm going to pause
it. Don't even get me started on the people who will buy a Monster cable for any reason whatsoever. Yeah, that's no different than my Viv.
But maybe what they're doing is they're saying, well, women want a more aesthetic site, a less utilitarian, more aesthetic site. And this is more aesthetic.
I think
it's
that's
prettier.
True. That's okay.
So just as you bought a more aesthetic computer, you don't want any less power. It's the same computers.
But don't mix the message with artists
and
giving.
I don't understand the featured artist and giving. I don't understand
that's
that.
Ludicrous. That's just a waste of space.
So I'm
just give me the computer, but give me an attractive.
Robin Moreno, I'm looking. It's like a blog entry, and it's got one crummy comment.
Yeah, no,
it's just marketing people gone haywire, because really there's nothing to do for marketing people. They have to justify their existence by creating crazy content along with their websites where they're trying to sell crap. That's
somebody's eating
opinion.
A cheese sandwich. That's appropriate.
It also seems a little odd.
That's what I'm saying. No, I saw the cheese sandwich. Like, what the H?
What is she eating if it's not
computers.
A cheese sandwich?
It does seem a little odd.
I don't need
a
cheese sandwich as my entree into learning about a netbook. Like, I'm capable of learning about a netbook without a cheese sandwich.
I don't know how this show's already off the track.
No, this is very newsworthy. I detect a little ambivalence on Dell's part because they didn't get Della.com. They've hidden it. They buried it. The URL is content.dell.com/us/en/home/della.aspx. They're a little ambivalent themselves. They're waiting to hear what we say
we
about
have
it.
A website for women.
Yeah, we do.
Find it.
Yeah, we have a women play. That's how they talk, right? Right. We have a women play.
Totally.
A women
it's called play. Della. We've got Della Burke lined up.
Do you think the Vivian Tam edition sold well?
No.
Really?
No, I don't know. I've never seen another one in the wild, but apparently recently I got some emails that said it showed up on Desperate Housewives, which bummed me out.
I think Veronica bummed
why?
Too.
No, I don't think
no?
so.
No, somebody I know.
So why would the Desperate Housewives plug bum you out? Because you hate that show?
No, because that made me think like, oh, now it's totally mainstream.
Yeah. Oh.
I had that moment. My favorite band just got huge.
Well, that's right. It's like showing up at a party with somebody
else
wearing
your
dress.
Never buy a Macintosh. They're on every TV show.
Well, I don't.
Or that Panasonic.
She's very anti-Macintosh, John. You should know that.
I'm the only person in the world who switched back.
Wow.
Switched
back. I'm not making that up. I did.
She's an anti-smoker.
She wants to be a smoker someday.
I can't stand a computer that bosses me around, where everything works fine as long as I do it exactly the way the computer wants me to do it. And Apple has laid out the rules for me to do it that way. And if I want to do it any differently
this is not
at
a
all,
new situation,
then I will
though.
Lose my ever-loving mind. Well, that's why. I'm just saying, that's why.
Okay.
I'm going to give Molly Wood a reason to hate Apple in a second. But before I do, I want to mention gotomeeting.com/twit. GoToMeeting is that product from Citrix that we talk about all the time that makes your meetings more visual, more vital, more effective, and you could try it free right now at gotomeeting.com/twit. Yeah, everybody drink. This is good. Aerate, drink, hydrate, take a walk.
Unstick from the chair.
John uses these ads as an opportunity to actually leave.
He's leaving.
We all have people we have to meet with in our jobs, you know. I mean, and the last thing nowadays you want to do is get in the car and survive swine flu in the middle seat and taking your shoes off and all that stuff. So use GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting means you can have a meeting that's as effective as a real-life in-person meeting, a sales presentation or product demos. You could collaborate. You could train. We use it on Maxwell's house. He shows his screenshots that way. You could try it free right now, and I think you're going to really like this. It's gotomeeting.com/twit. For $49 a month, all the meetings you want, includes unlimited voice over IP and phone teleconferencing. It is such a good deal. And right now, free. So there's no reason not to try it. GoToMeeting.com/twit. I'm a fan, and I know you will be, too. The folks at Citrix know what they're doing. Give them a try. So, Molly Wood.
Yes, sir.
Apple just released an update to OS 10
mm-hmm.
that was 493 megabytes. 493 megabytes. It fixed 16,000 files. And here's the funniest thing. It makes it run better. The Hackintoshes are running better. They're getting better battery life on the netbooks. I don't think Apple intended that. But this,
I don't know about that. You know, the funny thing
you think
about,
they might have wanted people to do Hackintoshes?
Well, but you know, the funny thing about Mac upgrades, unlike Windows upgrades, is that every time they do one, well, not every time, but most of the time, the performance of the machine actually improves. When you reboot it, it usually goes faster.
Temporarily.
They fix something.
They fix something, and it goes better. With every Windows fix, the machine is visibly slower.
Now, John, you got to...
Slower and slower and slower. They're so slow that you have to upgrade.
You got
to
say that Windows 7, though, is awesome. Have you been using Windows 7 yet?
No, I don't use Windows 7. I don't use anything that's in beta anymore.
Yeah, I don't blame you, but this is not in beta. This is ready to. This is cooked.
Yeah, that's what they
this
always
is
say.
Rolled.
So, what's your further beef of this Mac upgrade?
The size of it.
So what?
Well, that's less than half the 0.1 upgrade that I get from iTunes about every other freaking day.
That's another one.
That's just how they roll with the gigantic upgrade. Seriously, like a 0.1 update to iTunes will be 100 megs.
Yeah.
Or
but
more.
Isn't there the presumption that Mac users are higher echelon computer users who are obviously on high-level broadband?
No. What?
Well, if you're on dial-up, what do you do?
I don't think so.
Are you going to be able to download a half gigabyte update on dial-up?
I think that's part of the weirdness of the Apple ethos right now. Actually, is that they can't quite decide what they want to be because in the old days, right, the Mac was just
the
like it's super simple and that's what you use because it's just easy and the Mac is the machine that people buy for their moms right now because it's just easy, it just works, like you don't have to know that much about things. But then on the other hand, you've got the terminal thing and people digging into the Unix kernel and really getting command line on it. And so it's got this bizarre, I think, identity crisis about whether it's like
$2,000 a geek machine. $2,000 for a computer, you got broadband. You got monster broadband.
I guess that might be true.
I don't know. You think?
Definitely.
I think we
Who has dial-up? The question
well,
really
where's
is.
Where's Wolfram Alpha when we need it?
Well, they might just have slow DSL.
Maybe it has the answer. Maybe somebody out there knows
or
of some stats.
Comcast
I think it, nowadays, if somebody has, there's two groups that have dial-up still. Either people who really are out of touch and don't care anymore. In other words, they have the choice, but they say, I can't afford to spend $15 on high-speed internet. I'm gonna get AOL dial-up. More likely, though, it's people who live in rural areas who have no choice, right?
They're contemplating that or satellite, and they're just saying it's...
Now, they may have Macs. Like they could very legitimately have Macs.
But then they're screwed.
I don't think so. Because if you're outside of the broadband world, why are you going to spend big money unless it's your second home?
Maybe.
Why are you going to spend big money on a computer if you're outside of the broadband world? You're not. What?
Hey.
What?
You're a crack hoe. I'm sorry.
I'm buyingnet.com.
Story number five, crackhoe.com. The state of Alaska sent a cease and desist letter and made copyright claims against Houston-based DJ Shu Latif. Shu Latif registered crackhoe.com some years ago, 1998.
Genius.
Yeah, and just never really had a use for it until Sarah Palin ran for vice president. All she did was change crackhoe.com to redirect to the official website of Sarah Palin.
She being the domain owner, not
Shu Latif.
Sarah Palin.
No, Sarah Palin had nothing to do with it. Now, I don't think it's illegal to redirect a domain, is it?
No, why would it be?
Why would it be?
Well, the state of Alaska thinks it is. Alaska's Attorney General Michael Barnhill sent a cease and desist letter to Latif. It also asserts that Crackhoe made illegal use of the official seal of the state of Alaska. In fact, the site looks just like our site.
Well, maybe there's something there.
We can't understand
there
it. There is no site.
Confusion.
It goes to Sarah Palin's site.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Oh, that's funny.
That is classic.
Confusion.
So it doesn't do anything. So it's just a complete, it's a server level redirect. So it just goes straight there. It's no, wait, click here.
Well, I don't know. Let's try it.
That's the great thing about
everybody
copyright.
Go to crackhoe.
Well, no, she took
now we can't
took
get there because all
she
these.
She took down the redirect. Apparently,
oh,
she did
shoot.
Sort of. She backed down, and now she just has an image of Sarah Palin, and it links to the Sarah Palin.
Well, that's
website,
worse.
Which is actually potentially worse, but it's
well,
not a
if you saw the
image.
If you saw the image, you'd realize it's the most insult. I mean, this is ugly.
This is not cool. Wow. She doesn't have that many chins in real life.
Copyright's just such a blunt instrument. That seems like the safest thing to use against anybody.
I wonder
anybody.
If Palin
so
ever
if
wore
a
Palin
goes,
button.
Copyright.
It's an interesting question.
So there's no way they can cease and desist this person.
No,
why did this person...
threaten them with legal fees, basically.
Yeah.
I mean,
not necessarily. No, you just ignore it. Now you do what Mark Perkel, my sysop, does. He loves getting those letters. He puts them on the wall and
that's
just
saves them. That's what Pirate Bay did. That worked for them, didn't it?
Well, I mean, that Pirate Bay was a real target. Most of these cease and desist are just a
did
bluff.
You hear what Pirate Bay's, the latest thing they did? They did a kind of
this
a...
micropayments thing?
Yeah.
Unreal.
No, what's
so,
that?
Okay, so they're fine. What was it? $2.4 million, whatever. Mm-hmm. They said, okay, fine. What we're going to do is we're going to set up a micropayment site so that you can help pay our
legal fees,
but we recommend you pay such a low amount that it actually costs more for them to get the payment.
And so the concept here is they're depositing directly into the recipient's account so that all of the banking fees are accrued by whomever is receiving Pirate Bay's
settlement. They're calling it a distributed denial of dollars attack. So
the, they're devious. They're
playing dirty pool.
They do. I like them.
So they want to overload the lawyer who's collecting the settlement with internet traffic, damaging their ability to provide services. Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's a DDoS attack. What they're doing is they're... Okay, so they're sending... They say there's a surcharge of 2 Swedish kronors for the account holder. So they suggest you send him 1 Swedish kroner. So that every time he gets a kroner, it costs him 2.
Right, so he's in a whole one.
Exactly. He's in the whole one.
But that all the while, the fee is being
generally speaking,
taken down by
most of these systems do not do a negative
in
accrual.
In the long time.
They usually just zero out. I mean, PayPal, you can give them 2 cents and you get nothing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
They zero out. If it's less than
their minimum.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, the great thing about
it's
this
great
is
idea,
it's
though.
Just...
It's funny.
It's just deviousness.
Just messing
those
with
guys
just,
are troublemakers. Take my word for it.
They're going to cause problems down the road.
You heard it here first.
They're going to be a problem.
There you go.
How is it that we have Somali pirates and Pirate Bay all at the same time?
Do you remember that the Somali pirates are mad at Pirate Bay? They said, they're not pirates.
No way.
No, I'm not kidding.
You are making that.
No, I'm not kidding.
That's a fact.
So good.
They said, we are pirates. They're just nerds.
Who speaks for the Somali pirates?
Apparently.
Yeah, is there a spokesman?
That guy in New York. We haven't heard much about him. The one guy that is having the time of his life in Manhattan.
Oh, right. The happiest little pirate in the world. He's like 18.
They're not pirates. I am a pirate. They are not pirates.
Oh, and that voice
I don't know what the Somali accent is.
I don't know where the Somali accent is.
That was a Bengalese accent.
No, this is a Bengalese accent.
That's the Muppets.
I am not a pirate.
Jamie, speaking of the RIAA, were we? Yeah, I guess we kind of were.
Sure.
Jamie Thomas, you know, that poor woman.
Mm-hmm. Jamie.
Who was ordered to pay almost $250,000 to the recording industry. Then the judge decided he made a mistake. He had been wrong about one of his instructions to the jury. The judge said, I was listening to the recording industry. They set me up. It was wrong. So he said, we're going to have to do this again. You guys go to a settlement conference because we got to figure this out. The conference now has failed, and the entire case, we start over. It's a reset next month. It's going to be litigated again.
Yeah.
Again.
That's not really a surprise. I mean, they couldn't. There was no way they were going to reach a settlement because she
Yeah, well, she could pay him a dollar. Here's a dollar.
$250,000.
I'll give you Swedish kronas.
Right.
Because she, made available like 9 songs and they want $18 million.
$200,000 in damages.
$200,000.
Okay,
ridiculous.
So the last time I was on, we talked about sort of that this is their strategy just to scare people.
Right.
This has been their strategy all along. Obviously, it doesn't seem like it's the continuing strategy. So I have a question. Assuming that none of you guys steal music on a regular basis, mm-hmm. why don't you? John, why don't you? Do you steal movies, music?
I listen to classical music mostly.
So, you can't steal that. They're all dead.
I just turn it on the
radio.
I have a 24/7
I should
FM
tell you,
feed in my
John
house.
Considers Metallica classical music,
okay.
just so
right.
you know.
So the music that you listen to, there's no need to steal it because you have everything you want.
I play the radio, believe it or not. I'm like that type of person. I have.
Do you listen to the Sunday morning opera on the... You do.
No, you know what? The one I like, they used to have, they changed it from Sunday morning to Sunday afternoon on the our local classical station. They have this thing where they have these young prodigies that they're like 9 years old and they have them play this ridiculous stuff. You go, wow.
That's cool.
Where do these kids
come from?
And the kids are funny. They go up and they do one-liners with the people. It's a really an outstanding show. Can't think of the name of it, though.
Is it on?
No, I don't steal music.
Why don't you steal music, Molly?
I don't know. I guess I don't want. I'm not a stealer.
Who needs this music? Most music's crap.
And it's cheap. I don't know. Music's Cole? Cheap now.
So you have an open vehicle.
Now.
Leo?
What?
Why don't you steal music?
I steal music.
It's cheap and mostly
Why do you steal it? I mean, you're a commie.
Actually, here's an example. Coldplay just offered their album for free. Download it immediately.
Great.
Even though I'd be willing to pay for it. I buy a lot of music. I haven't stolen music in
you're
a while.
One of the
but
few
I stole
people,
it at the time.
Well, I think you're fair game because you give your content away.
I'll tell you. If I go online... and try to buy a song, and I go everywhere, and that song is not for sale. Then I'm willing to download it. If they're not going to be,
where are you going to download from?
Well, that's the problem. You can't do it anymore. You know where? I'll tell you my secret.
See, that's honestly, I am too lazy to steal music.
I'll tell you my
it's
secret.
It's too hard.
It's easy.
Now there's enough of a barrier of entry. Right. I got my little credit card there. I'm good to go.
It's so easy to buy. I don't even use a credit card. I just click it. Right.
Yeah.
iTunes, you
well,
don't
yeah, it's already, I mean, so that's what I mean, the info's already in there. It's
by
just
the
like the
edge of their seat.
What's your secret?
Yeah, what's your secret?
News groups.
Oh, yeah.
News group, and here's the problem. BitTorrent, you can be tracked. You really can be tracked. You're basically making a connection with somebody.
Yeah, everybody's tracked.
And everybody knows your IP address. News groups, especially if you use a site like, say, Super News or Easy News, they don't keep their logs. They don't. There's no way of tracking you. It's a completely anonymous transaction. So you can download anything you want.
Why don't you go to the IRC?
I have a relative who gets all his music and movies basically from news groups. He's shameless.
I think I think if you're going to steal music, your best bet is the IRC, even though it takes forever because you
That's dangerous because you don't know where you're getting.
Well, that's my point. Is the reason why people aren't stealing music is because they fear viruses
and they're right.
Spyware.
Right. They just found a Trojan horse in Windows, the Windows 7 beta. So if you download it from BitTorrent, many people got a Trojan horse in there. Same thing happened with iWork, Apple's iWork. That's the only known Apple Trojan.
Well, okay, what Trojans there are associated with an MP3 file?
You can't put in a Trojan in an MP3 file, but often what they'll do is they'll make zip or they'll disguise it.
And most people don't know to distinguish between an MP3 file and any other file.
The default behavior of Windows is to hide the extension. So you download something.
When you get Windows, the first thing you do is you go to the tab that turns that off immediately.
I agree.
But 99% of people don't.
No,
so
they should. And if they don't and they get Trojans, well, you know, what can I say?
What are the legal implications of the RIAA posting
Microsoft's
Trojans?
Microsoft's at fault.
Yeah, no, they got the wrong
default setting is bad.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, that's come up a lot, that the RIAA and other companies have essentially posted malware
illegal
sharing sites and stuff, which I think is illegal.
It's totally illegal.
It keeps happening.
I don't see that that's a problem.
This has always been the argument for, what you were getting at a minute ago has always been the argument for cheap, available, easy to download, DRM-free, high-quality music online, which it's ludicrous that it's been resisted for so long. And now it's the argument for cheap, easily available, DRM-free, easy to obtain video content that the movie industry is continuing to miss. Like,
I bet you piracy has completely plummeted because it's so easy to get music now.
I think so.
It's so inexpensive.
Yeah. I would take that bet.
Really? You think? No. Well, let's find out. Let's ask Wolfram.
Piracy's down.
I think music piracy's down, and I would say that video piracy is way up. Television and movie piracy is way up. But it's so cheap and easy to get music now. Point of access is everything.
Still too expensive. It's dollars too high.
Apparently, because Apple started charging $1.29, you know, on some songs, those songs are not selling well.
Yeah, because
that's way too much.
It should be a nickel.
In my day, you used to get an album for $1.29.
For a nickel.
The only people who do that are people who have Sonos and want to keep their music for a long time and stream it around their house.
Most music is crap.
Well, that's the problem, by the way, is the argument for a subscription service like Rhapsody, Napster, or the Zune Store. And I load up my Zune with music for $15 a month. Actually, it's $5 because I get 10 free songs. So in effect, it's $5 a month. And I can listen to anything. And I wouldn't, I'll be honest with you, most of the stuff that's on my Zune, I would never buy.
And that's this Microsoft ad that's going around right now
that's
with the certified financial
$30,000 per iPod, yeah.
Which costs $30,000.
Come on.
How many of you have iPods you have $30,000 worth of music on?
Right.
But how many songs have I bought seven times?
Well,
in various
that's,
ways.
I
like
actually,
CDs.
I am a little bit tempted by the subscription model because I do find digital media weirdly hard to keep track of.
Yeah.
Like
you lose stuff. Yeah.
It's like on the
reason to give up on the whole thing.
By the way, doesn't make it very easy to deal with your digital media because if you've got it trapped on one iPod, God forbid, you can't just sync it with another computer.
It's the reason why getting an NAS drive is worth it because if you put all your stuff on a central drive, I haven't lost any media since I did that.
Most people end up having it hanging around.
That's a good idea.
There's little fragments of music on all sorts of places, and I can't get it all synced up. And
I just have music dumped folders.
You need your own crawler.
Wait till the twins are a little bit older, because what will happen is they buy songs. My kids buy songs I bought. It's on different computers. It's all over the place. I would love to do an inventory of the music in the house and get it all together,
don't
but who has time for that?
Don't you default it all to a central drive? Every time I install iTunes on a new computer, I do that.
It's too complicated.
You know, my point about the whole RIAA thing and the viruses is fear is an inhibitor to making decisions. So if you're afraid of getting viruses, if you're afraid of getting sued, you won't download.
I agree.
I think that's probably why
they seed viruses into this stuff.
I just had to go back to that because I don't see what the difference is between that and, say, a honeypot.
Right.
I don't get it.
Same thing.
The only reason I suggest the IRC, for one thing, I don't think there's much of that going on, is because I've known a couple of IRC administrators. And I asked them point blank about the music trading that goes on some of these channels. And I said, has anybody from the IRC ever come around and asked for a log of IPs or anything from you ever? He says, never.
Right. Yeah. It's arcane for them to actually pursue anyone because if they were getting the media for it, they'd have to explain what IRC was, and every person that they're trying to scare off would go, oh, I don't use that IRC, so why? I don't got to worry.
Same reason news groups work. True. It's too arcane, and most people aren't doing it, and they're not going to go after those
the
guys.
The IRC?
They come after me for money every year and in my paycheck.
Are those the revenueers?
I hate them.
We got some bourbon we're cooking in the back.
We do. Molly Wood brought me some really good. This is called Bullet Bourbon. Is that how you pronounce Bullet? Bullet Bourbon?
I don't really know. I call it Bullet, but I'm not sure. I'm sure I'll be corrected.
It's pretty good.
Bullet Bourbon.
Bullet Bourbon.
I taste it.
Kentucky Straight Bourbon. Well, let's open her up.
I taste it. I mean,
I'll try it.
I don't want to force anyone.
I might dump this wine right into my smoothie cup.
Let's bring out the shot glasses.
That's not tacky, right?
Do we have shot glasses? I don't think
you better get shot glasses from now on.
You can pour a little on top of this.
The way things are going on this show.
Do we have any
shot glasses?
I'm dumping the wine.
John's showing his speedo. Molly and I are scantily clad, and we've got the bourbon open.
Oh, man. There was quite a...
It's
no, just drink it out of the bottle.
What? Really? No, come on.
Oh, come on. Just, you know...
Oh, you ruined it.
Oh, my God. That's good.
All right.
It's nice, right?
It's very... Mm-hmm. You've had it.
Yeah.
It's very smooth.
Whiskey is a thing now.
Well, before we get to that, there's quite a few more, but I do want to mention Squarespace. Have you ever tried Squarespace? Anybody? Squarespace? Yeah, there goes John.
I use Squarespace.
Do you use Squarespace for your websites?
I've got some I'm developing them.
He says he's developing some sites. He's got two in the oven.
Ooh.
For Squarespace. Squarespace is, I'm going to show you some Squarespace so you can see it. Squarespace, I don't want to say a blogging engine because that's the first thing it looks like. You know, it's a website. Hosted website engine that is just state-of-the-art. I mean, it is so gorgeous. In terms of capabilities, it's not just a blog. You can put a photo gallery on there, a forum, maps. There is blogging, of course, but it's more like a website design tool. Incredible templates, very easy to modify. With drag and drop, they use Ajax so you can redesign it. But if you're a CSS expert, you have full access to the CSS too. You can do anything you want because you can put JavaScript in there. So you really have complete control over this site. And I can tell you, now we've moved Dick DiBartolo over there. We're moving our Twit blog over there. Alex Lindsay's about to move everything from PixelCore over there. It's just a really easy way to do a website. And because the hosting is using a very powerful virtual server technology, they can really add capacity as necessary. You just never run out of bandwidth. You can't break a Squarespace site. E-commerce, everything's on there. I want you to try it free. 2 weeks free, no credit card needed. You're just going to go and sign up right now. Squarespace.com/twit. Squarespace.com/twit. And if you decide to sign up, use Twit as the promo code, and you'll be able to get 10% off the Squarespace. Already low price. These guys are brilliant programmers. This is kind of the next gen in web design. Squarespace.com/twit. Try it free for 14 days. No commitment, no credit card. And by the way, it imports from WordPress, Blogger, Movable Type, and Typepad, and exports back out too, so you're never trapped. I think that's really important.
Yeah, that's actually one of the good things.
It's kind of neat that they do that. I mean, that, a lot of companies are afraid to do that because they're afraid
people... Yeah, they want to lock you in and screw you.
Yeah, screw them. Not Squarespace. Squarespace.com/twit. It used to be in radio, you couldn't have... The FCC prohibited having any booze in the studio. Although there were exceptions. Because, for instance, you know, you traditionally do the thing where the CHP comes in and they breathalyze you and you drink. And the disc jockey gets drunker and drunker and they're testing you. And they say, now you're point one, now you're point two. You don't remember that. We used to do that every year. It was just an excuse to get sloshed.
Who would remember that? You get drunker and drunker.
So, Google failure.
Yeah, Google this week, you go and you do a search. What happened? Because that didn't happen to me, but the Gmail and the searches.
It was only parts of the country.
Gmail, search, docs, voice.
Jeez.
14% of users.
Wow.
Lost connectivity with the old Goog.
And why? They routed all the traffic to Asia.
Yeah.
Somebody made a mistake.
Once again, pretty much just the cruel reminder that we shouldn't be quite as dependent boozy? On the goog as we are.
Oh, yes.
No, in fact...
and or boozy.
It's not the last... very recently they had a configuration issue. What is going on with Google? Remember that when you go to Google and said you're a spyware site, except that it said that to everybody?
Right.
Which and then again, that, that was human error.
And there was a big Gmail outage not that long before that, I think, too.
Is this stuff that hard?
Well, but when you have that much volume, I think it's really tough to test this internally before you release your fixes. Because how do you simulate that
much
volume?
The problem is Google is so secretive, we don't really know how this came about.
It sounds like
an
engineer just screwed up.
And they changed the story two or three times.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, as far as I can tell, it was they kind of soft-peddled it after.
They did that last time, too. They said, well, we did it. It was more like,
It just makes you realize, again, the dependency issue.
Well, that's
the
cloud.
How much redundancy do you need to have?
Cloud problems.
Yeah.
I love the cloud. I think netbooks succeed because of the cloud. All you really need is an opening to the internet, and that's all. And you got it. That's the future.
But I think you have to, in some way, mirror...
You've
or
gotta
create
have
redundancies
local
or separate systems that are
stuff.
Local. I agree.
You know, once in a while you're down. It just means you should go out and get some fresh air. Come on.
It
she gets some fresh air anyway.
I don't want to.
I mean,
by the way, it's officially hotter outside now than it is in here.
See?
It is?
Yeah, I just went out there.
Are you sure about that?
See?
Really?
You thought it was bad here.
It's really hot outside.
Wow. Crazy hot.
That's not
it's like
okay.
100.
I'm looking forward to that.
I mean, it's 94 in here, according to your Google
yeah,
thing,
yeah.
in this room.
Yeah.
And it's about 101 outside.
Well, good.
I think what happens...
And they don't
the
have
last...
lemonade and bourbon outside.
Yeah.
The last time there was a big Google outage, actually, I know someone who works at a company that relies on a lot of Google traffic, and they had a significant monetary impact as a result of the Google
I guess
outage.
If you're
that's
running business
outage.
On the cloud,
so if you're
that's
running a,
problem. A
business on the cloud, if you're relying on searches,
yeah.
Google searches for most of your traffic,
oh,
which almost everybody is at this point.
That's a good point.
And then if you're relying on them for data, analytics data, I think
Google
these
Voice.
Are pretty... It's not just about not being able to send an email, which sucks, but it's about...
No, when Google's down, the internet's down.
An yeah. actual monetary
Google
impact.
Google is the internet.
Yeah. Google is the internet.
Is that a good thing?
No.
No.
Of course not.
No
but
one
it
should
is.
Be
it's a
the
fact.
Internet. Only,
what do you
right?
do?
Well, but I think Yahoo
I think we should shut him down.
Saw their build searches go Google. Up. Yahoo saw their searches go up something like 19% during that time frame, and there was a lot of interesting chatter about how I had to search on Yahoo. It was so awful.
Oh, kill me! No. And seriously,
shoot me first.
I'm with you.
So awful. By the way, Wolfram Alpha says it's 97 degrees outside.
I tried.
See, that's what
way,
it is. It's a weather surface.
I tried to
how
use,
would Wolfram Alpha know it was 97?
It knows the weather, but I tried to search it for information on music piracy rates. Nothing.
It's because
it was like
it's not a search engine.
I don't 3 degrees
warmer.
It's not a search engine.
Yeah, but shouldn't I be able to put in music
possible.
Piracy and get some data?
It's not a search. That's a search engine.
That's what
metaphor.
I'm saying. Though,
not
when,
a search engine.
What would I say to it?
You would say compare. I don't know.
You can.
It's like a
it's
cute
not,
guy at a bar.
Doesn't...
Like I got nothing.
You are three of the smartest people I know, and the three of you cannot figure out how to describe this thing. And that cracks
I've described it. It's the CIA fact book on steroids.
Yes.
Plus a calculator.
Okay.
A graphing calculator.
Well, that's the best description.
I've Here's
heard.
A story for you, John. We talked about this when the publishers. Man, they are just so conservative. They didn't like the fact that the Kindle had voice transcription, you know, that would speak your books out loud. And they complained to Amazon. And Amazon, really within a week of the release of the Kindle 2, said, all right, we'll put a switch in. They're starting to use it. Random House is now putting out books that 40 titles, including titles from Toni Morrison and Stephen King, that you cannot text to speech on the Kindle.
They hate the blind.
That's it. I love it. It's an anti-blind thing.
Oh, the National Federation of the Blind had a huge demonstration.
Good.
A huge demonstration against the Authors Guild and for accessibility and said that this is
and
absolutely
they should definitely pick it Random House, seems
this
to me.
This is just another case of a company not getting it.
It's ridiculous.
It's stupid. It's ridiculous. They also have so much control over all the flags that are on the books themselves and their connectivity to each individual Kindle that you could hypothetically say to them, I'm blind, cut me some slack, and they could open up your Kindle.
Oh, really?
I think
there's no reason from a technology standpoint.
Sure,
why they
you're right.
I wonder if there's
right.
a flag where they could, if you wanted to, you're the publisher, you have it flagged so it reads in Chinese. It'd be kind of cool.
Really, really fast.
I think I think that I think it's shameful that Amazon caved on the text-to-speech feature issue, and I think it's shameful the way the publishers
Amazon are just trying to get this thing out there. I think they have no choice.
Well, maybe that's the issue. Maybe once they get enough market share, they'll just tell the publishers
point, Amazon's going to be wagging the dog. There's no doubt about it. And the publishers know it.
You heard my conspiracy theory. The fact that they were able to flip that switch.
And I believe you're right.
Yeah, and they were able to flip
that switch. Wait, I didn't hear it. Go back.
They were able to flip that switch within a week, right? It wasn't that hard. They were ready for this. They knew immediately when they put this together, they said the Authors Guild's going to get pissed off because of their audiobook rights. Build in the switch. Build in the capability. And let's see what happens. When this happens, when Random House or somebody starts flipping this switch, let's see what kind of protests happen. That's exactly what's going to happen here. It's very smart. Jeff Bezos is a smart fella. He said, all right, fine. They don't like it. We'll build in the switch. Let's see what happens. And I think you're going to see so many protests. It's going to hurt the publishing companies. It's going to weaken them. And the next time Amazon says we're going to add a feature, they're going to think twice about contesting it.
What about paying extra buck for text-to-speech enabled?
I don't want to pay anything for it. It sounds like crap.
Well, actually,
it's not
I know,
true
but you're
text
not blind.
But if you're blind, aren't you getting the audio?
You would probably be buying the audio books, but
not
there's some books that don't have audio.
There's no question in my mind.
Then that to me is a legitimately offensive accessibility issue. I'm not paying a dollar extra for something that ought to be like it's just an accessibility thing, right? I mean, I guess there are already so many hoops that you have to jump through if you're blind. You have to buy, like, screen reader software, and you have to do this and that and the other thing. And it's like, this is built in. It sounds kind of crappy. Just make it easy.
I think it would be great for basically...
I think it's a good idea, though.
Yeah, and for reading blogs.
I would
be
mad if
you were blind and you wanted somebody to read your blogs, this would be way better than having Jaws read you on Eudora Lite, which is what they have to do now.
It's a fantastic solution. Amazon knows it's in the right... They knew that the Authors Guild was stupid about this. The publishers
were stupid.
They've
been stupid about a lot of stuff. They said about the Google stuff.
Yeah, exactly. The Google Books service. Amazon's did the right thing, which is, okay, you don't like it? We'll let you do that.
Right.
See what happens.
It's on you.
It's on you now.
That's a good conspiracy theory. I like it.
I like it, too.
It's not really... You see, the problem with... by the way, I made a point of this recently. We have to be careful when we call something a conspiracy. A conspiracy means there's people conspiring.
It's not
a
conspiracy.
Just one guy.
It's called a strategy.
It's a strategy.
Where's the bourbon?
A strategy theory.
Where do you think? It's by me.
Where else would it be?
This is a story worth talking about. Intel fined $1.5
billion. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm surprised we didn't lead with this. This is a monster.
But this is a better
story. I'll tell you why it's not a monster. So this is the European Union. And for 9 years or something, they've been going on saying that Intel, which we all know Intel does. I mean, this is Intel's MO. Has been saying to companies, hey, we'll give you a discount as long as you don't buy any of those AMD parts. Or we'll give you some marketing money, but you better not have AMD on your parts list. Dell said that you notice Dell does not sell AMD computers. Why do you think?
Well, I know the real reason.
Why?
Michael Dell, in fact, I have the document at home because I was doing an expert witness thing.
Sounds like a conspiracy theory.
I know,
it's not a conspiracy theory. It was he made testimony. They asked him specifically in one of these cases that way back when. What was the quid pro? Because Dell came out and testified for Intel in a case. He was on the stand. And so the AMD guys got wind of what might have been going on. So they grilled Michael about what was the quid pro quo. And he says, well, I made a deal with Intel. And they said, I'm always going to get the first shot at all their newest chips. But I can never use AMD chips.
Yeah.
And that's it. Was that all it was, Mr. Dell? Yeah, that seemed like a good idea to me.
Yeah. Well, Dell has no choice. So the EU, I think they proved the case. AMD was bitter, and they, for years they've been saying, please, Intel is shutting us down. Intel's using monopoly to do this. Well, so they fine them. But here's the deal. It's a huge fine. It's $1.45 billion.
It's bigger than the Microsoft fine.
They were allowed to fine them up to 10% of the revenues they make per year from the European Union. They only fine them 4%. So essentially, this is the cost of doing business for Intel. This is less than a slap on the wrist. They're saying... we'll tax you 4%. You go ahead, you do this anti-competitive stuff, you put AMD out of business, we'll take 4%. It's nothing.
Well,
it's nothing.
Yeah.
They didn't even take the 10% they could have taken.
It's not like they're giving it to AMD.
I know, that's the funny thing about it.
It's not like AMD gives it. Is there anything attached to it? Is it just a fine? There's no sort of change in behavior.
They have to change their behavior.
They do, okay.
But I mean, so much of what Intel does is... on that borderline. I mean, just
they
their advertising and their marketing partners.
Right.
You know
they
that Intel jingle? I don't know if everybody knows
ding,
this,
ding,
but
ding.
It's two seconds in an ad, but they'll pay Dell or HP,
they make it
25-35% of their advertising costs.
And that's part of the deal. We will give you the co-op money as long as we don't have any problems with the supply chain. And there's no AMD. That's how they do it. It's basically, here's how we give you bags of cash. It was the same business for the cable TV business. Mm-hmm. When we would go, when Tech TV would go to a cable channel and say, we'd like you to carry Tech TV, they come with a little black bag.
Right.
With marketing dollars.
Right.
It's co-marketing money.
Now, is that per subscriber was how we did it there? Or was it
I think it was just a flat, here's a million and a half bucks.
It was just, it was bag money.
It's bag money.
Wow.
Here's a million and a half bucks. It's marketing money. Yeah, that's right. The ticket. And that's the way people do business. And I think this is what Intel does. They say, we're going to push it as far as we can. When we get caught, we'll pay you the 4%. That's the cost of doing business. We still get to keep 96%. And
that's
by the way,
for one
plus,
shot.
What are the odds that they're actually
going to play? It's not 1.45 a year.
Okay, now
and they're not going to pay. They're just going to appeal it for the next 10 years, and then
they'll end up paying.
But it'll be like
they
a
will
long
appeal,
time from
and the
now.
Reason they have to appeal is because they're also being sued in the U.S. or investigated in the U.S. for the same behaviors. So they have to pursue it.
This is the cost of doing business. What? And I'm just speaking sort of devil's advocate. Sort of more from the free market perspective. What prevents AMD from doing this?
They're not a monopoly.
They're not big enough.
The key to this only works.
You have
to
be a monopoly.
You have to have a dominant.
Apple engages in monopolistic power or monopolistic behavior all the time, but they're so small that it doesn't matter.
Right.
They can't win.
And that's
like that.
Well, and that's the whole point of antitrust regulation is that you can do this unless you have such a dominant market position that it hurts competitiveness and innovation. Mm-hmm. And that's what the EU was saying. This is bad for competitive position. It's bad for innovation. Mm. And they're right. And Intel's going to get away with it because essentially, big deal. $1.5 billion, no problem. We got it.
It's about what it costs. Yeah. It's not.
It's marketing money.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to take a break. Twitter. I just said it to see what John would do. Twitter. No, this is actually a relevant story that you're going to like about Twitter.
Uh-huh.
I'm not kidding.
Oh.
Somebody told me I shouldn't do teases in these shows because, and it's true, from my broadcast background, I'm used to teasing into commercials, right? So you'll stick around. He pointed out, well, all I have to do is fast forward. You're just making people fast forward.
You're making them fast forward. Right, because especially the teaser's really good.
Yeah. Oh, I got to hear that story.
I like it.
You girls take off your tops while I talk about...
Sexy time. Hold on.
Sexy time. While I talk about... Oh, my God, they're doing it. While I talk about Audible Platinum, ladies and gentlemen, Audible is the audiobooks that we were talking about. Let me tell you, there is nothing like an Audible book. You can listen to text-to-speech on the Kindle till you turn blue in the face. When you're listening to audio from Audible, you're listening to a performance, a great book read by somebody who is a pro, a real genius at dramatization. I think it's better than than watching a movie. I feel like it's a visual thing. My mind is much more effective than my brain is at creating. I can't look because now she's doing something with her top.
And she just, is ripped. Let me just say,
it just really shouldn't. I'm just gonna be. No, it's okay. Go ahead. I'm not looking. I've got a hand over.
Really crazy hot.
Wow.
And that's with two T's, ladies and gentlemen.
I was having an unconscious moment.
That's okay. No, please don't stop on my account. Audible.com. Let's just show that real quickly. This is the Audible website. If you go to audible.com/twit2, you can sign up for the Platinum account. That gives you 2 books a month. I do 2 books a month easily. You can see that once you start looking around at audible.com, there's so much great stuff there that 2 books a month is almost not enough. I'm going to recommend, as we were talking about movies, I'm going to recommend Angels and Demons. Before you go see the movie, listen. I say read, but in deference to people who don't like it, I'm going to say listen to Angels and Demons, Dan Brown's prequel to The Amazing Da Vinci Code. This is the way. This will be as visual, as vivid as anything Tom Hanks could put on the screen. Or Ron Howard. Or anything Becky Worley could do with her blouse. Angels and Demons. It's not really a blouse.
No.
It's more like a tank top.
It is a tankini.
Twit now stands for This Week in Tube Tops.
Sweet! Okay, straps are down. Just kidding.
Well, mayday, mayday.
I moved to Petaluma. Again. I actually say I moved to Petaluma for the tube tops.
Wow.
This is the place.
If you like, it is 1,000 degrees here. Who lives here? You. Wow. Well, I'm just saying.
Sweaty
it's
people.
Really hot here.
Wait a minute. You live in the East Bay. It gets hot in the East Bay.
Not like this.
I just watched the temperature on the car thing just go steadily up as I drove here.
It's not normally this hot. In fact, the reason I don't have AC. The reason I don't have AC in here is because it doesn't normally get that hot in Petaluma, but it is all of a sudden. I don't understand.
I think it's great. I love
it. It's nice. Warming. I like the weather, and it's good tomato growing weather.
It's good tomato growing weather. We get great strawberries, tomatoes, and wine.
Yeah.
Because you know why? It's cool at night. You get nice, hot, sunny days, nice, cool evenings. Makes a great wine. But I'm not going to talk about wine right now. I'm talking about Audible.com. Angels and Demons from Dan Brown. That's our pick of the week. You get this book free when you go to audible.com/twit2. Wait a minute. What am I saying? You don't just get this book free. You can get this book and The Da Vinci Code free. Two books.
Wait, there's more.
But wait.
There's more.
Set it and forget it.
Are you getting this camera guy?
By the way, there were 3 ShamWows by the door for you guys, and I forgot them.
You forgot my ShamWow?
I totally blew it on your
ShamWow. I need a ShamWow.
Oh, man.
I know.
You loser.
You could have used one in here.
I know.
You can mop up. Think Seriously. About all the sweat you can mop up with one ShamWow.
Yeah.
They're made in Germany. They make great stuff.
They make great stuff.
We're almost through the show, right?
Angels. Yes, we are. Angels and Demons. And The Da Vinci Code. Read the whole oeuvre from Dan Brown right now by going to audible.com/twit2. It's free. It's great. You're going to love it. I am a big Audible. Do you want to hear a little Angels and Demons? You just relax. Take it easy. Take a little break. Here's a little Angels and Demons. We're going to have a little listening break while everybody just chills out.
As he climbed, his vision began to blur. There was a thundering in his ears. I must reach her.
I must.
But when he looked up again, the woman had disappeared. In her place stood an old man with rotting teeth.
Hey!
The man stared down, curling his lips into a lonely grimace. Brr. Then he let out a scream of anguish that resounded across the desert. Robert Langdon awoke with a start from his nightmare. The phone beside his bed was ringing.
It is Richard
Post sound effects
narration. And you know, I think that's one thing Audible is missing is those sound effects.
We should probably do a whole thing and overdub sound effects.
That would be great.
That's fun.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of mystery.
Like Masterpiece, or was it?
Mystery Science Theater 3000 for audiobooks.
I like it.
That could be cool.
It's a whole new podcast.
The publishers would probably hate it.
Good. Audible.com/twit2. We thank them so much for their support of This Week in Tech. So, this is actually going to be to your point, John, that Twitter is a nightmare. Somebody Twittered that Prop 8 had been overturned by the California Supreme Court, and if you followed the link, it turned out it was a link to a March 2008 article. It was a year-old article that was, in fact, the Supreme Court decision that allowed Prop 8 to be put on the ballot.
That's funny.
But everybody on Twitter didn't follow the article. They just retweeted, and there was this storm on Twitter. Yeah, Prop 8's been overturned. This is the Prop 8 is the California proposition that made it illegal to gay marriage in California. And very controversial in California. It's already been overturned in about 8 states. It's going to be overturned in California. There's no question about it. But this wasn't the decision. What it showed is that people are fairly uncritical about the news they get on Twitter.
Well, the scary thing is the genesis of the story looked like it came from the L.A. Times.
It came from the L.A. Times.
The original tweet itself.
Yeah, and the L.A. Times people admitted they screwed up.
Right.
Oh, wait a minute. You're telling me that professional journalists?
Yeah. They made a mistake.
And the L.A. Times Twitter.
But wait, that doesn't make any sense.
I know, right?
They're trained.
I'm shocked.
They've been to journalism school, John.
Huh.
And also appalled.
I don't know. That's it.
Oh, so maybe this isn't an anti-Twitter story.
Well, it's an
aha.
Exactly. Well, if it wasn't for these trained journalists, we wouldn't be having these issues.
It's the same story as like the blogs repeated a story over and over. It's a story about uncritical thinking.
It's an echo chamber, and this is something we really got to train people in is
Craigslist
thinking
erotic
again.
Ad concession.
Yes, RTFM.
Craigslist says, we won't have erotic ads, which I'm sorry about, but... they've decided, what are they going to have? Adult services instead.
Well, what they've said is we will totally have erotic ads. They'll just be in a different part of the site. They'll just have a different name.
It's not in any way a concession.
No. No. Well, they actually, the one big concession that they made, and I'm surprised about this and interested to see how they implement it, because they have been saying for years there is absolutely no way that we can manually review all of the ads that we get. There's just that's impossible for us. And so the big concession that they supposedly have made
we'll
have a new erotic services ghetto, but we'll have some people actually looking at
these. I manually review every one of these ads. It's not hard to do.
That no bourbon's making
you manually do it?
Manually.
Manually, and it's
not hard. Well,
that's
a lot cheaper that way.
Oh, Lord.
Wow.
Can I get a third Mayday?
Oh.
A third Mayday.
Mayday, Mayday, Mayday.
I need a rescue.
Yeah, do you guys remember the website that warned Johns of where stings were happening?
Good.
And it would just be sort of a news group where they'd post on
service.
A Friday night saying,
is that
don't
illegal?
Go to...
No, shouldn't be.
Well, that was the question. And they just knew where the stakeouts were. They posted online and people went to other corners.
Yeah.
And
like the anti-flash mob.
Legality issues, but more this is a cat and mouse issue of, well, if not here, then where? Why
they're going to have an adult services link that section that looks identical to the erotic services section. They say it's going to be manually reviewed, but they're still going to, I mean, you're just
what are they
going to
do? What does manual review
you're just
mean?
Going to see the prostitution ads.
You got a guy named
Emmanuel.
It has
the furniture section. Like, it's
and he's going to review it.
No, it has to say massage.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if you look at the adult section, they basically just all say massage.
Yeah.
So, I'm
which
looking
is what
at
they
now.
Said before, you know?
Unfortunately, this goes to erotic services. Let's see.
Like it's his first time.
So I aim to please baby. Call me 24 hours, all uppercase. You know, nice. This is like, you know, hot Latin mammy, you will love me. 27. She's in San Jose.
Wow.
Unforgettable Asian massage service. She's in San Rafael.
Wait a minute. Now this is
sexy
turning
Latina,
into a whole other thing.
Sexy Latina playmate.
I never.
Charming
one other
and classy Asian CMTS.
They cost
okay,
money
fine.
Now.
That's
oh, they didn't cost money before?
Massage
they were
therapist.
Free before?
They You needed to put in a credit card number, I think, but you didn't have to
oh, that's
pay. And now they cost $10 and you can repost for $5. But doesn't that just make it more likely that they'll be commercially... That there'll be
viable.
Commercial enterprise type yes. links instead of just some person who's looking for the
John, don't read it out loud.
Well, it's just this picture. It's just hilarious.
No.
This is under MILF special.
Oh, Lord.
Wow. Wow.
Unsee.
Yep.
Undo. No.
I think this is just total, and I hate to use this phrase, but it's so appropriate, lip service. To,
whoa, boy,
to the Craigslist killer issue. This is just
give
lip service to the Craigslist killer issue. They had to do something in response to the negative press that they got. 99% of the people who hear this story go, ah, thank God, Craigslist is doing something so something like this will never happen again.
Yeah, yeah. And then they never think about
business
it again. It's
usual.
Done.
Do you think,
business is
really
usual.
Like. Do you think anybody believes that Craigslist is actually making a fundamental change?
99% of the people who heard this story have never been on Craigslist.
Yeah,
they will nope. be shortly.
Becky, I don't know about that.
Becky is saying what
no,
every mainstream media
few,
person
most
knows.
Most people, Craigslist is still not fully mainstream.
Yeah.
No, but Becky's saying what every mainstream media person knows, which is you print the story, people read it. They're done.
Oh, thank God.
And it's over.
It's over.
And it's the best way to handle this.
Yeah,
and any
this
company in this situation
MSNBC,
should do the same thing.
And it says it's half-baked.
MSNBC.
You know, I mean, I'm just wondering if that press is going away. I think Craigslist does not have the benefit of the doubt of the media
good.
Anymore.
Well, good.
And it does seem to be
but they
ongoing,
do have a peace sign favicon. So I'm
They're so nice.
They're so nice.
They're peace
so
loving.
Corny.
They're totally not murderers.
They're yucky.
Yeah, they're so totally not. Yeah.
You do have to feel for Craig though that it was
oh,
called
I feel
the
so
Craigslist
sorry.
Murderer. That's
oh,
not
yeah.
good.
No, that really that's not
that's
fair.
Not I mean it's not his fault.
But again, that's just the sensationalism to sort of prove my point, which is
that's the media
it's
doing
a
its
new
job.
Thing to most people. Right. Ergo, it's Craigslist. That's
what
the
what
problem,
do they mean when they
the
say 200
like
roses? Does anybody
right.
know what that
is? Is that a special code? 200 roses?
Look, I'm just down with 420 for the first time, so just...
You didn't know about 420?
I'm so square,
I can't believe you just admitted that. You know that we're on the air right now, right?
I'm so square.
That's adorable. You and I are going out. We've got things to talk about.
I need help. I stick exclusively with alcohol. It's so great. Why try anything else?
Oh, I agree. In fact, I don't drink at all.
I kind of like this story from Danger Mouse, which is the guys, of course, who are part of Gnarls Barkley, which has been huge, very successful. But Danger Mouse is a mashup DJ who did get in a little bit of trouble. I thought it was brilliant. They did something called the Gray Album. They took the Beatles' White Album, and they mixed together the Black Album from, it was a rap artist, it's escaped me a moment ago. But
oh,
it was
Jay-Z, right?
Jay-Z, that's right.
Wow, I knew that.
And it was a great, you're hip, you're
Two
with
points.
It, you're cool. 2 points. And it was a really great mix. I mean, to hear the Beatles' White Album with Jay-Z, I mean, really was great. This guy's brilliant, Danger Mouse.
It's like bourbon and lemonade.
It's like
wow.
bourbon and lemonade. It's something that just goes together. And you might not have expected it.
Exactly.
But when they hit, they hit. By the way, it's hitting right now. So,
wow.
This is the new album. It's Dark Night of the Soul. It's an album-length piece of music by Danger Mouse, Sparkle Horse, and a host of guest vocalists. David Lynch Photography, inspired by the music. So you buy this, what are you going to get? A blank CDR. Because they can't publish it. Mm-hmm. Because for legal reasons, the CDR contains no music. Use it as you will. Due to an ongoing dispute with EMI over the Gray album, Danger Mouse is unable to release the recorded music for Dark Night of the Soul without fear of being sued.
Can you play us a clip?
I can't. It's blank.
Let me listen.
So I love it. What they say is, download this and put it on the blank CDR because we can't publish it. Wow. I think that's kind of cool.
So
it's kind of like Prince and the symbol.
It's a symbol.
So the distinction being they can put it online available for download without the same legal implications? Or is this just marketing?
They sneakily put it online, I guess.
The whole thing
maybe. Could be They're marketing. Just saying, like, if anybody's going to get in trouble, it's going to be you, not us, which, frankly, I think is kind of sucky. I don't appreciate that.
So did we...
Don't put the burden of breaking the law
on
me.
Would you like to hear a little bit of this?
Yeah, if you can bring it up.
All right. Wait a minute. Let me find it.
So did you talk last week about the Duke Nukem story?
No, I didn't. This is the story for this week. Let's talk about
it. Duke Nukem Forever.
Duke Nukem's gone. Remember, Duke Nukem Forever was going to be for the last 8 or 9 years, the next version of Duke Nukem.
They could have let this slide for another 10 years. I don't understand why they had to shut it down.
They were paying people to work on it.
What were the classic vaporware products? Because there were a few of these,
right? There's quite a few. You know, that's actually something worth revisiting. I think you'd have to do a little research, but there's a lot of it. I can't think of
off the top of my head. Too much bourbon, but
what
I
about
think
the movie phone that.
There's some classic software. Lotus have something that was never came out, and there are quite a few of these programs that were promised, never released. Classic vaporware, and I think Duke Nukem Forever, partly because it was named Forever.
Yeah, it's taken forever.
Is the classic 9 or 10 years since they promised it? Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, they started releasing trailers again. It was like, oh, it's still alive. 3D Realms it's has gone. Finally said it's gone. But here's the interesting conspiracy theory. Two sites have been registered, two domain names, Save Duke and Save Duke Nukem, registered before the announcement. And all of a sudden, these sites are starting to release artwork, video, collateral that was created for Duke Nukem
Forever.
Oh, so
the whole thing could be a marketing ploy.
The studio was like a sub-studio, right? It was 3D Realms, and then
there's always these deals. You have 3D Realms makes it, and then you have a deal with Take-Two.
To distribute it and release it.
Take-Two says, we didn't have any deal to give them money. We just had the distribution rights. So it wasn't our fault. It wasn't something we had to deal with. Mm. 3D Realms basically said, 10 years, it's time to pull the plug on this thing. We're not going to get a product out. But I wonder, and it's not, I can't take credit for this.
Well, people inside probably knew. People inside 3D Realms knew this was coming, and they probably were trying to prepare a little grassroots
that's
campaign.
That's a good counter theory. I like it.
For when it happened. So they're like, okay, well, this is going to happen, but maybe we can, everybody's got that idea now. Like, if I just go to the internet will save me. So they probably thought, we'll just get our grassroots movement going now.
I got two mommies here.
Mommy.
And
mommy.
A mother. Two mommies and a mother.
Did you see that cute baby out there?
There was a cute baby? Oh, Malachi was out there. Isn't he the sweetest baby? He's 1 year old. How old is Eli?
1.5.
He's like 18 months, yeah.
So they're the same age?
No, Eli is 2 years and 2 months.
2 years old? So he's walking, talking.
Oh, he's a crazy man.
Smoking dope.
Yeah,
he's ready.
For
sure. He's out there.
He knows all about 420.
He's so much cooler than Aunt Becky.
I'm a super good mom.
Let me introduce you to my 14-year-old. You'll be very...
Anyway, you were saying.
So Facebook, for a long time, has pulled pictures of lactating, breastfeeding mothers. Mm-hmm. I mean, these aren't sexy pictures. These are pictures moms put up on their own Facebook page. Here's my baby. I'm breastfeeding. Isn't that cute? And Facebook's been pulling them.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time. For a couple of years now. I love TechCrunch. Finally sat down and said, wait a minute. You're pulling pictures of breastfeeding moms, but you're leaving sites up that say the Holocaust didn't happen,
right,
that Jews are evil. You're leaving these hate sites up. Facebook says, well, they're not hate sites. It's this is a political point of view. There's no
free
justification.
Their own terms of service say no hate, so I don't get it. This is just so obvious. It's a no-brainer.
I think we should boycott Facebook.
Thank you. I would be glad to.
Here comes the plug. My whole Buzz report this week actually was about these companies who are just engaged in this bizarro hypocrisy around censorship, because it turns out censorship is kind of hard to pull off without looking like an a-hole.
Yeah.
Because you find yourself backed into these weird double standards all the time.
It opens a can of worms.
And they basically have said, well, okay, breasts, naked breasts are obscene, which bite me, but okay. And also, we have to respect free speech. So then pretty soon you have, right, like breastfeeding banned and
you can't have it both
ways. Pro-Holocaust
sites. You cannot have it both ways.
Holocaust
denial. I wonder if they would allow breastfeeding Nazis.
That's okay.
Must be.
As long as they don't believe the
Holocaust. As long as there are no pictures of nipple. Oh, God, nipple.
Oh,
areola. It's going to ruin America.
Is it nipple or areola that they're concerned about?
Hard to say.
Depends.
I guess. I mean, if there was a... You could,
what is it that they're pulling?
So I'm not getting into the logistics.
If you're breastfeeding and you're fully locked on, it's
okay?
It's
if you can see the nipple. That's
if you can see nipple.
Right. Okay, so I was doing a story about hot moms clubs, and I found this site on Facebook.
Oh, dear.
Come on!
Now, that's on Facebook.
This is on Facebook.
That girl's got a fake front end.
And this site is not about breastfeeding.
And that's allowed. That's obviously allowed.
There's no nipple.
No,
that's why. That's not ruining America because of the no nipple.
You know, but...
She's got a nice smile, that girl.
It's large. Her smile.
It's waxing.
Yeah, you know, personally, if people... I don't see the need to do the pictures on the breastfeeding, but that's just me. So, of course,
you know, wait
whatever.
A minute, though. Like, this is... This is my private page, right? Only my friends see this page. And I have a new baby, and I want to share a picture, a great picture of me... Right. With the baby, you guys both have babies.
Plus, people get
I'm
very
in love
serious
with the baby.
About breastfeeding.
Well, yeah, that's
there could
part
be
of
actually
it.
A picture that's like, here's how to latch, right? Like here I am. It could be a tutorial, and Facebook would be like, oh no.
I think the kids can figure that out.
You'd be surprised.
No, oh no! In fact, you know who we called for advice when we were having latching issues? Mimi, your wife.
Mm.
And Mimi was very helpful. My wife called. John's wife.
Plus, a little John Dvorak trivia right there.
Yeah,
wife named Mimi.
Mimi.
Didn't oh, was that a secret?
Didn't know that.
No.
Not like, you know, I think.
Mimi's great, by
her
the way.
Her email address is a secret.
John's wife is fantastic, and she was great. Jennifer talked to her for a long time. She said, eventually, you'll be able to walk on concrete with your nipples.
and my wife does that, as a matter of fact. Damnedest thing you've ever seen.
It won't hurt at all.
It'll be okay.
No, she
when
was
dogs
really.
Chew on them.
It's a whole other thing.
Bring it.
Now, Facebook would ban this show.
They would, the whole conversation. But if I said the Holocaust never happened and all Jews deserve to die, then that would be okay.
But did that's
you
see,
on your Facebook.
Did you see some of, and this is a Facebook fan page, it's a public page, as opposed to a private page of my friends saying, and my family saying, look, here's my beautiful baby.
Right.
I think this is appalling. I think Facebook is really overstepped.
Here's the question, right? Because censorship is extremely tricky, and you will find yourself in these scenarios because it's a really hard line to walk. So should Facebook go all the way censoring, or should they not at all? Because then they become MySpace, and they're totally terrible. And one of the things people like about Facebook is it's a nicer neighborhood than MySpace.
Don't they face a larger legal issue where you're deciding whether you're a carrier or a publisher?
I think there's that, but the other thing is I think they should just back off. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is the point of the nipple controversy?
Yeah, yeah. I agree.
It has been years now. It's 2 years in the coming, the nipple thing, that they still keep
it's
saying.
Ridiculous.
Like, no.
But,
I like to know who specifically is responsible, because there is a person.
Though there's a team. In fact, we've seen this pictures of this team. It's a large number of employees whose sole responsibility is combing through this material on Facebook and deciding what not to put there. Now, a lot of this stuff on Facebook is drunk teenagers. And frankly, as a parent of a teenager, I think it's not a bad idea for Facebook to say, well, you know, we don't want this stuff here. This is stuff that your employers might see, you know. But although, again, it's private. It's on your private page. But I can understand why they want to prevent that.
Let's take the whole Malcolm Gladwell approach and just say, if you had to look at the page for 10 seconds, wouldn't you know what was really bad and what was really good and what was marginal and you don't want to make a
decision
about it?
But you know what? That's the thing, right? Facebook, okay, for one thing, the internet is global. Facebook is available all over the world. And the blink approach to obscenity is very different in very different countries. I mean, I think the lesson is that censorship is
Frenchmen
way harder than you would
think. The same way as a Southern Baptist.
Well, I mean, but in France or Germany, there's a distinctly different response to a nipple and to a Holocaust denial.
But look, I work for a big company that has to make these decisions every day about what's appropriate for the bell curve. What's appropriate. And that's what you're being paid for.
And they're not as stupid as Facebook.
And you have to make some tough calls, and you have to have a pair of stones and sometimes do it. Mm-hmm. Just make the right calls and then let the gray area stuff live in the gray area.
So are we in agreement that they made the wrong call?
Yeah.
Leave the breastfeeders alone and get rid of the nutters.
This is some level of immaturity. I mean, I'm almost getting the sense it's like a 14-year-old
it
making
like
this decision.
It is like that.
Oh, you know, I don't know that the Jewish thing is, the whole story's not in yet. Oh, God, no, there's a breast.
Yeah.
Oh,
it's that they're making the decision.
While digging in their nose.
It's that they're making the decisions for the 14-year-old. Like, the whole thing about the internet now is that child porn is the terror. That's the thing that is so scary. So anything that might appear porny to a child has to go.
Can I bring up this whole cybersecurity? You put it in the links. I thought it was interesting that, you know, sexting, all of the initiatives that have been started about
really
cybersecurity. And I think that the point here, aside from getting into the obvious
sexting. Let's just say what the story is. So there are two bills in front of the House of Representatives right now. One is against cyberbullying. It's the Meghan Meyer Act that is inspired by the fact that this teenage girl was kind of coerced into killing herself by an adult that lived next door. Cyberbullying, no question about it. And this second bill, which has just recently been announced, which is more, let's fund education about sexting. Right. So it's kind of a namby-pamby bill.
Right.
There are two bills. I mean, one clearly is misguided. The idea of having something special about cyberbullying. It's a very nebulous thing. Yeah. I don't want to shut you guys down. If you have a different opinion, please tell me. But I'm of the opinion this is bogus. There's no reason Congress should be legislating somehow against bullying that is online is different from bullying in public.
Mm-hmm. I think you need to step up to the 10,000-foot view and just see what it's like for parents today. If you go online and search, I was researching a story about 4 months ago before the sexting story really hit, and you searched cybersecurity for parents, the rules that were out there, everywhere I looked, were from the days when we all had AOL accounts. It was so inappropriate. It was all about stranger danger.
What
it had
a surprise.
Nothing to do with social networking, with texting,
yes, right.
With totally networked teens. And so I think what you have to recognize from the 10,000-foot view is that parents are having a major paradigm shift about what's at stake
online. And they have
online.
No idea what's
going
on.
It's not stranger danger.
Yeah.
That is a minimal concern, and your kids know about that way more than you do. They know a Nigerian scam from any other.
I never worried about my kids. Never worried about my kids.
It's not stranger danger.
Yeah.
The issue at hand is all about the people you know and how the medium makes meanness so exaggerated and makes sexuality so exaggerated. And so we're in a hyper-sexualized environment and the medium only exacerbates that. So I think what you have to recognize is all these little attempts to legislate things are really just stabs as parents try and grasp the change. Mm-hmm. And so I try not to get too mired down in the little stuff and just recognize parents are changing
their
minds.
I think you're right. But should Congress be involved in this?
Congress can't stop itself, really, from taking out its tiny little knives every time they find out about something.
It's good for
votes. Literally like they find out about it.
Yeah, legislating stupidity.
No, that's Leo's right. This is just a
pandering.
Showboating.
It is.
It's
and they're writing. They're essentially writing dead letter.
They
laws.
Know they can't.
And they know it.
These laws are going to be just go. It's the same like the laws against kissing a donkey in Omaha.
Yeah.
I mean, there's laws in the books that are crazy, and they've never been taken off the books, and they're still illegal to kiss a donkey.
Vestigial appendages. Mm-hmm.
One last story, and then we're going to go home.
No, you got one last story, and then we talk about Twitter.
Wow, the tables have turned.
This is what he said.
This is actually a wonderful story. It's a victory story. How many of you received calls saying your warranty is about to expire?
I always ask for the supervisor.
All the time.
You know, I did the same thing. I said, please put me on your do not call list. That didn't stop them. Partly because it's coming from a bunch. Now, Becky, you. Bunch of different people. You do this for ABC. You're the consumer reporter. Have you been covering this story?
I've just been looking into it recently because the calls have just gotten so intense.
I get four or five a week now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Non-stop.
Are they coming from Canada? What are these area codes?
I don't know.
The area code's probably spoofed.
Probably.
Yeah.
And they're weird.
And the robocalls.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
They're not humans. They say your warranty's about
warning.
To expire.
This warning. Is the second call. That the factory
yes.
warranty on your vehicle.
Call.
It is always the second call. Right?
Is about to
or
expire.
Or we have made multiple attempts to reach you.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is that the idea that you sign up for these aftermarket
No.
Warranties.
It has nothing to do with anything.
It's just to harvest credit card numbers, apparently.
There is no warranty involved. People get these even if they don't have a car.
Yep.
But this is merely to get your credit card number. Now, some of them may be legit, but
no.
But I don't think most of them are not. It's merely to get your credit card number. You will be charged. You will not receive anything. It's a ripoff.
Huh.
Apparently, the seller has taken in more than $10 million as a result of the calls.
Wow.
So here's Dane's call list. Dane just brought his phone in to me. This is his call list. Are these all
from the same?
He's been saving these. 818-416. That's Toronto. 810-800-815-2627-0881. You've been saving these. Good for you. He's been saving. This is dozens.
Should send those to Congress.
Well, the good news.
Congress is
Here's the good news. The FTC filed complaints on Thursday against two companies. I'm sure there's more, but two companies engaged in this. Of course, it didn't. Nobody did anything until somebody called Charles Schumer.
Right.
And I love Chuck Schumer.
He is awesome.
He was in on Capitol Hill when they called his cell phone.
Doesn't anybody but me find it disgusting that these guys, unless it actually affects them directly, don't do anything.
Why do you think
to learn?
I'm sure some member of Congress had a sexting incident too. I mean, this is all about literally what comes into their consciousness at any given moment.
How do you think stories get on TV?
Why don't we just take and if there was no Congress, we'd be just as well off.
Well, that's true.
Just let the president do everything.
Here's why it's an issue.
Chuck's getting her done.
Here's why it's an issue, because these guys are so out of touch. So they're finally learning about stuff years after their constituency has been bitching and moaning about it.
Why hasn't the FTC done anything?
Well, they are now.
Why hasn't any of the people who enforce the do not call registry done anything?
That's a good point, because aren't you legally, if you say, please, I tried it, please place me on your do not call list. The guy said, oh, yes, sir, fine. And I immediately got another call the next day.
I think that some of these guys do actually provide these weak warrantees that don't work, but they provide you paperwork.
No, we don't know this.
I've seen.
You're guessing.
No, I read one article from the New York Times, which said...
Oh, the New York Times. I'm sorry.
Oh, I all right, love get it when this. John calls into question the New York Times.
Yeah.
Wow, talk about a conspiracy theorist.
FTC says as many as 1.8 million calls a day. They dial every number in a given area code, which is why you're getting on your cell phone. And you know, normally your cell phone's not listed and doesn't get marketing calls, but they're just random calling. Has nothing to do with the fact that you have a car or not, let alone a warranty. Including many numbers on the National Do Not Call Registry. Once on the line, recipients were misled into believing they were extending their original vehicle warranty. The seller took more than $10 million as a result of these calls.
Oh, man, these guys have got a great scam going.
Yeah, this is a drop in the bucket, too, because it's car warranties now, and it'll be something else tomorrow. It'll be home insurance warranties, because these are companies, but anybody can robo-dial, right?
It's coming from 416. That's Toronto. What do I do? Am I supposed to pursue them in Canada now? I mean, it's very difficult to pursue these guys internationally. Anyway, thank goodness they're finally filing a complaint against two companies, but I think you're right. I don't think we've seen the end of this by any means.
So annoying.
So I proclaim victory, but only a temporary victory.
There's no victory involved.
There's no victory.
We should just disconnect all phones and the
internet.
I think
we should just have more bourbon and lemonade and say the hell with it. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Another twit is in the can. All right, now that we've gotten rid of Dvorak and Worley and Wood, I want to give you the full interview that we had with Stephen Rolfram. This interview was conducted on Saturday, May 16th. It was right in the middle of the launch of Wolfram Alpha. We were very grateful to Stephen for giving us half an hour to talk to him. I think a fascinating interview, but I'll let you be the judge of that. So we're just going to stick this at the end. If you're not interested in Stephen Wolfram and the story behind Wolfram Alpha, just you could stop your player now. Otherwise, there's a little extra. It's about a half an hour interview with Stephen Wolfram. Hello, this is Leo.
Hi, I'm Stephen Wolfram. Yeah.
Stephen, thank you so much for taking some time to talk to us. I'm sure there's a crazy day for you.
A little bit, yes.
A celebratory day as well?
Oh, it's always exciting to see a new project launched out into the wild, yes. And many things have gone very well.
How long have you been working on Wolfram Alpha?
Well, let's see. I mean, the foundations I've sort of been laying for maybe 23 years or so, but the actual final project is the last 4 or 5 years.
That's a long time. And most of that in stealth mode. I mean, this is the first we heard about it was just a few months ago.
Yes, indeed. I wasn't sure it was going to work until quite recently. So I wasn't going to start talking about it until I was really sure this was actually something that wasn't completely crazy. I've been thinking about this for a long time and had been concluding several times that no, it's too early, it's the wrong decade to try and do this project. And I finally, 4 or 5 years ago, I thought, okay, I'm finally to the point where this project is not completely crazy to try doing. And then for a while, there kept on being these issues that were like, there's this particular problem, and there's not going to be any way to solve this problem. And then we finally found some way to solve it. And it's only probably in the last year or so that I've become convinced that, yes, it's actually possible to sort of take a reasonable shot at sort of making all the world's knowledge computable. And that's so I wasn't about to tell people about it, but at the point where it was still appeared to be sort of completely crazy.
What happened that made it possible? Was it computational power? Was it the internet? I mean, what is it that what hit critical mass?
Right. So I mean, there's several things. Computational power is one thing. I mean, you have to be able to sort of in web type time actually sort of do interesting computations and get back the results. Another thing was sort of that there is the web and that there's a way to deliver, you know, something like this to people as sort of a medium for doing that. Another is that sort of it becomes more obvious kind of just how much information there is in the world and what kind of thing it is by just sort of looking around the web. I mean, that ends up not being, in the case of what we do, that, you know, the raw web is not the primary sort of source of information and data that we have, but it tells one a lot about sort of what is out there, what kinds of things are sort of available. But for me, the biggest things, there were two really big things which happened to be sort of my other two big life projects. One of them is Mathematica, the other one is my new kind of science. You know, Mathematica is this broad language that gets used by lots of the sort of world's leading R&D folk and so on, and lots of others. It's this language that we're developing for the last 23 years that sort of is a general symbolic language that lets one represent all kinds of knowledge and sort of implement, sort of it contains sort of a huge collection of the world's possible algorithms. And that was kind of the layer that had to exist in order to make Wolfram Alpha possible. I mean, if without that layer, if I'd been kind of trying to write it in some low-level language or something like that, it would have been a completely inconceivable project. And the other big thing was my work in science, where both there's some content of sort of understanding the world in computational terms, but probably more important was the fact that I sort of discovered from studying kind of things out in the computational universe and so on, I discovered this sort of paradigmatic fact that even though there may be a great deal of sort of richness and complexity in the phenomena you see, there can be sort of simple programs, simple frameworks that lie underneath those phenomena. And that sort of realization is what brought me to the idea that, okay, even though there's a huge amount of different kinds of knowledge and so on in the world, it's conceivable that there are sort of frameworks underneath it that are simple enough it's conceivable and sort of with finite resources to actually build something that sort of captures a decent part of what might be computable about the world. I think actually over time, I'm probably going to understand that. I kind of have this meta theory about people, which is that people have at most one big idea, so to speak. And Wolfram Alpha is sort of my third big project. And I kind of think there are more connections even than I yet realize between these projects because, as I say, people have at most one big idea. So for me, all these three projects have to be the same idea at some level.
In some way, yeah. Well, but what it strikes me that looking at your history, at your biography, that what has been key to this is your interdisciplinary approach. You started with physics, realized that computation was important, combined the two knowledge bases together, and you've produced Mathematica. And as a result, I think maybe you could say it's all one idea, but you've had to take these different approaches into it that maybe hadn't synthesized before.
Right. Right. No, it's certainly true. I mean, one of the things that's made Wolfram Alpha sort of both possible and fun for me, in a sense, is that, I happen to have worked on lots of different areas of, science and analysis of things and all sorts of other kinds of things. And so kind of this idea of sort of collect the world's computable knowledge and kind of put it together into something, that becomes, I kind of had... some perspective on sort of what's out there from the fact that I've, ended up f- for quite fortuitous reasons sometimes, working in lots of different areas.
You've said that one of the most important things that came out of this computational approach to science is this notion of exploring the universe of possible programs.
Yes.
Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, what we're used to when we like create software or something is we say, okay, we want to achieve some particular objective with the software we write. You know, let's sit down as software engineers and kind of start...
It's purpose-built.
Yeah, right. And I mean, what I kind of got into realizing that it was worth doing is
I hear Windows complaining. I'll let you.
Yes. Right now, I just.
It's good to know that even a brilliant person like you can have trouble with Windows.
Yes. It's the misbehaving computers. That's bad.
Now, can you fix that first, Stephen, and then we can worry about solving the problems of the world? Just get the computers working.
But back to sort of the computational use.
Yes.
The typical program we build is something we specifically engineer for a particular purpose.
Right.
But so one question is, if you think about all possible programs, just from programs that are just the shortest programs you just write down, it's sort of a one line of code, or it's something you represent by just saying a typical kind of thing I looked at with these things called cellular automata, where you just have a line of black and white cells.
Right.
You just have a rule that says, a particular cell will be a color that's determined by the configuration of cells on the line above it, and so on.
Right. Conway's Game of Life, for instance.
Yeah, that's an example. Yeah. That's actually a bit more complicated than a lot of the things that I looked at. But one of the things that's interesting about programs that are that simple is that you can say, let me look at all possible programs of a particular kind. And so then there's the question, what do all possible programs do? You know, are most of them just completely stupid, uninteresting, mm-hmm. or do some of them behave in really interesting ways? And the sort of a big thing that I discovered now, I don't know, 25 years ago or something now, is a little bit more actually, is that if you look at sort of all possible programs, yes, there are ones that are really uninteresting. Like, you start off with one black cell at the top and it just keeps on going, all the way down the page and nothing changes.
Right.
But then, a decent fraction of the time, some decent percentage of the time, what you get is some incredibly elaborate pattern. And so, what's interesting about that? Well, the first thing that I got really interested in was the elaborate patterns that you get look an awful lot like elaborate patterns that you see in nature. Hmm. And so it's kind of like, we know that nature kind of has this secret that lets it make all this complicated stuff that we don't seem to be able to emulate when we sort of do things with engineering. But what this is kind of suggesting is that if nature is just sort of sampling the computational universe kind of arbitrarily, it's easily going to run into these kind of programs that have this property that even though you may start them off in a simple way and the programs may be very simple, the patterns they produce are really complicated.
Now you've got to natural selection.
Well, kind of. Actually, we sort of see a different twist on natural selection, because one of the things natural selection suggests is, when we see all the complexity of organisms that exist today, maybe what we're really seeing is kind of a frozen version of a giant history book. We're seeing all the details of the organisms that exist today were the result of this thing that happened, sometime in the Cretaceous period, this other thing that happened, and so on and so on and so on. All these kind of seemingly arbitrary kind of choices. It seems like, we're kind of freezing a lot of work that sort of was done making all these arbitrary choices. That's kind of the typical view of natural selection. There's an alternative view which says maybe a lot of the complexity that we see in today's organisms doesn't come from that kind of frozen historical accident at all. Instead, maybe what it comes from is just this fundamental fact about the ways that things get generated that says that even many simple programs produce really complicated behavior. And the point being that if natural systems actually happen to pick programs that have this feature that they produce really complicated behavior, you'll see really complicated behavior in the organisms. Even though there was no sort of detailed historical accident or detailed kind of molding by the environment that went on. And one of the things I've noticed is that that if you look at different kinds of organisms, there's the question of do you get, if you sample, I don't know, one of my favorite examples is the mollusk shells of the world. Right? You look at the patterns on the mollusk shells of the world, and some of them are very simple. You know, you could imagine that they were produced by a simple program, just little stripes or spots or something. And then there are these really elaborate ones. Another example would be dinosaurs. You know, you have a lot of simple shapes, and then you have the stegosaurus and so on. And the question is, you know, did the stegosaurus or did the complicated mollusk pattern get sort of molded by some elaborate series of events in the history of natural selection? Or is it just that out of the space of possible programs for making these organisms, it just so happens that there are few that sort of spontaneously produce this kind of complexity? And I kind of suspect that it's much more on the side of there just happen to be programs that produce this great complexity rather than it's sort of carefully molded by natural selection.
How is it different from an infinite number of monkeys and an infinite number of typewriters? I mean, are we able to express all the possibilities, all the possible computational programs?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is the interesting thing, that if you start from the very simplest ones, you can basically just go through. There's, you know, with cellular automata, I kind of numbered them from, you know, there's a big block from 0 to 255, then there's a bunch of other ones, and, you know, every one of these kind of numbered programs, you can just go through and enumerate possible programs. And so, for example, you could ask the question, you can do this kind of enumeration for lots of kinds of things. I don't know, you could enumerate possible axiom systems of mathematics. Mm-hmm. You could enumerate possible laws of physics. You could do all kinds of enumerations. The reason people generally hadn't thought that that was worth doing is because, you know, when you do an enumeration, you might, with a computer, you might be able to study the first billion or the first trillion of something.
Right.
Unless something interesting happens in the really small, really simple ones, it's sort of not worthwhile to do this enumeration. So kind of one of the big sort of discoveries of my science adventure has been that even among the really simple ones that you sort of get to quickly in one of these enumerations, there's a lot of rich, interesting stuff that maybe just that might be just like what we see in nature and so on. So one of the consequences for technology is that means that you can sort of find technology by just sort of enumerating possible programs and so on. I mean, the analogy I like to use is, you know, there's this computational universe out there of possible programs, possible algorithms, and so on. And it's kind of like when we go out into the material world and we're interested in finding, you know, we look at different materials. We discover, you know, magnetite. We discover liquid crystals. We discover, some type of resin or something. And at first, it just seems like, well, this is a fun thing. You know, it has some weird property. And then later we realize, no, actually, there's a human purpose. There's a technological purpose for which this is really important. Hmm. So then, you know, we go and, you know, pick up all the gallium in the world or something, and we discover that it's useful for, you know, some kind of display or something like that. And so similarly, in the computational universe, we've got all these possible simple programs out there. And sort of one of the questions is, given one of these simple programs which has some very elaborate behavior, perhaps, you know, is it useful for something? And, that's where we kind of go out and, you know, in fact, in the development of Mathematica and in the development of Wolfram Alpha, this is a pretty common thing that we do, sometimes call it algorithm discovery. You know, you just go out into the computational universe and you go searching through lots and lots of different possible algorithms to find one that satisfies some particular objective that you're trying to reach.
So through human history, it's really been serendipity. You're saying you can do this in a intentional way.
Yes, that's right. I mean, so you might say, I mean, it's always interesting to look at things that have emerged in human history in different areas and say, why this one and not another one? Like, for example, in chemistry, you know, there are particular chemicals people have studied. In mathematics, there are particular underlying axiom systems that people have studied. You know, what's special about these things? Are they special because they have some particular property, or are they simply special because of the sort of the course of history? Actually, one of the things I find most sort of ironic is, you were talking about natural selection earlier.
Yeah.
You know, people think of biology as the very accidental science,
Right.
The one where, you know, what we have today is the result of a whole series of accidents.
Right.
But they think of mathematics, for example, as the exact opposite of the very non-accidental, completely determined by higher principles kind of science. I actually think it's the opposite way around.
How interesting. So our understanding of the physical laws of the mathematical theory really is just this is what happened to happen.
Well, I think so. But, I mean, for example, in mathematics, you know, you can just say, you know, mathematics gets based on these axiom systems, you know, from people like Euclid and so on.
Right.
And the question is, why do the particular axiom systems, which are the basis of our arithmetic or our logic or something like that, why did we look at these axiom systems and not other ones? And, you know, we gave them names like arithmetic or logic or whatever else. And I think it's basically purely historical. In other words, I think that there are zillions of other axiom systems out there that we could have studied, but, you know, the Babylonians happened to start studying, you know, arithmetic and geometry.
Right. So Wolfram Alpha is then an engine to kind of start making these connections in a different way, to maybe open us up to different ways of looking at things.
Well, I think that in a sense, I view Wolfram Alpha as being...
Or is it just a historical engine?
Well, okay. So I think it's sort of the... at some level, I view it almost at the stage it's at today, which is sort of I view as its beginning stage, as being almost a prosaic kind of application of these types of ideas. I kind of think about it like when one discovered universal computing, you know, in 1936 or whatever. You know, what were the one might have imagined that there would be all sorts of very sort of high-minded consequences for mathematics, for, you know, artificial intelligence, whatever else. But in actuality, the first applications of, you know, the idea of universal computing were things like databases and later word processors and so on. And so similarly now, I view Wolfram Alpha as being sort of an application of the paradigm of this kind of science that you can make a lot from fairly small principles. But I think there's a lot more that one can do in the future. And I mean, right now, Wolfram Alpha is mostly making use of kind of old kind of science facts. It's making use of, you know, the models and methods and so on that have been developed in science and physics and financial analysis and lots of other areas over the course of the last few hundred years. What this kind of, what the ultimate sort of direction that one can go in is not just to say, here's a question we have to ask which can be answered by existing science, and now Wolfram Alpha can actually, you know, answer it quickly for you on the web type thing, but say, here's a question that I have for which I have to sort of invent a new model, something that science has never produced for us, to go out and discover sort of a new algorithm. Now can we do this thing of going out and sort of going and sampling, mining the computational universe to find something to sort of invent on the fly, something that's never been created before. And that's, you know, that's a future direction for Wolfram Alpha. One of the challenges, one of the things I don't yet know is, you know, are computers of today fast enough to make that particular direction? You know, how far can we go in that direction, you know, in the next year or 2 years or something like that? And to what extent do we have to wait for, you know, the next wave of speed of computers to really be able to do exciting things with that?
This isn't artificial intelligence, though.
No, it's I don't know what it depends what you mean by that. I mean, in you know, the tradition of artificial intelligence has tended to be, you know, let's see what humans do and let's make it bigger, faster, stronger.
Duplicate it, yeah.
And what Wolfram Alpha has done, so typically what that turns into is to say, you know, let's take processes of human reasoning and things like this, and let's see whether we can sort of automate those processes and so on. And so, you know, like when you're solving a physics problem, you can say, you know, what happens in the physics situation? Well, let me reason through it. Let me say, you know, this pushes that and that pushes this and so on and so on and so on. That's what people used to do, you know, in the Middle Ages, for example. That was kind of, that was the mode of doing natural philosophy, is people would debate it and have sort of arguments about it and so on. And then what happened in science was, you know, along came Newton and his friends, and they said, no, you can forget about all this human reasoning stuff for figuring out physics. Let's just blast our way through it using mathematical principles and just get to the answer.
Right.
And in a sense, Wolfram Alpha is sort of continuing that tradition of let's just use mathematical, computational, algorithmic methods to just sort of blast through to the answer. And so what we're doing is essentially a very non-human approach to blasting through to the answering of questions. We're not doing something that, if you think of other kinds of technological things like, I don't know, flying or something, you know, you can fly like a bird or you can fly like an aeroplane. And aeroplanes have fairly little relation in detail to the operation of birds. And we're taking more of the aeroplane sort of let's just blast through to the results kind of approach, which is sort of a different branch from the kind of traditional thinking about artificial intelligence.
Walk me through the process of, I'll enter a query into a Wolfram Alpha. What happens then?
Okay, so the first thing is we have to figure out what you're talking about. So there's sort of a linguistic analysis phase. So maybe there are words that you use, and those words may be very ambiguous. So we have to have known, we have sort of an a priori probability distribution for, you know, given that we know where you are from GOIP data, if you're asking about a city, we can say there's a certain weighting based on how far the city is from where you are, what the population of the city is, what the kind of fame index, as we call it, for the city based on sort of crawls of the web that we've done and so on is. That sort of tells us what's that entity that you're talking about. Then there's sort of the question of trying to understand this kind of often very very shortened, in fact, it's sometimes easier for us when it's a very shortened input that doesn't have too many extra irrelevant words in it. We just want, just ask us the concept, so to speak. Right. And then the first problem is to sort of figure out what the input was. What is this, let's do the analysis of the input. Then we turn that input into a sort of precise symbolic representation where every kind of relation, every aspect of the computation is represented in a precise way. Then what we do is basically say, okay, this is a precise representation of what a person was talking about. Now we have these things, we call them internally scanners, which are just these different sort of types of computations that can be run on different inputs. And then we say, okay, there's this whole sort of bag of possible scanners. Which ones of you have something interesting to say about that input?
Wow.
That sort of precise representation of the input. And then you'll get a bunch of results in what we call pods. Those different pods will be the results from these different scanners and so on. What's happening there is we're taking, well, as a practical matter, a request comes in and it immediately gets parallelized across a bunch of different machines, and these different pods are being returned by different machines. Of course, if you ask about it today, there's a load balancing issue to do with all of our multiple compute clusters and so on that's messing up some queries that have certain kinds of parallelization. We just figured out, just before this call, my team figured out basically how to fix this. So this will be this will be fixed before our official launch here. Ignoring that little micro footnote, the basic idea is you're kind of parallelizing the question, and then what has to happen is these computations get done. How do the computations get? Well, I should say, the output from all these computations is a presentation. And so then sort of there's the question of, given all these computations that got done, how do we prioritize which things are important about the answers that are given, and how do we then present those answers? And we have all sorts of algorithms and heuristics for deciding sort of what are the right visual representations, what are the right tabular forms, what are the important pieces, what are the less important pieces, to try and give people sort of a good, quick, cognitive sense of what the important result is.
It's a huge amount
of
computation.
Another part of this is when the computations are getting done inside, there's sort of two big pieces to that. One is what to compute, and the other is sort of where to get the data from to ground that computation. And so one big thing that we've done a lot of is data curation. We kind of take all these different sources of data and try and sort of combine them and correlate them and validate them and sort of put them through this largely automated pipeline, but it isn't completely automated. It has sort of human domain experts also kind of in the loop trying to make sure that the data that we get from all these different domains is actually as good as it can be and consistent and so on. So we have this sort of a big amounts of data that are both static or kind of real-time feeds and so on of data, then we have to combine that with the computations that you can do. And essentially, these computations are kind of the fruits of the achievements of science and all these other areas of systematic knowledge. They're kind of the we're kind of trying to encapsulate in what's ultimately Mathematica programs inside sort of all of these different things that we've learned how to compute in science and engineering and other areas. So, I mean, in, you know, inside Wolfram Alpha, what is it? It's 5 million lines of Mathematica code and God knows how many terabytes of data and all kinds of real-time feeds and these types of things.
Do you have a proprietary database? How is it structured?
So I mean, the kind of the symbolic representation inside is that's all Mathematica code. And so it's using sort of Mathematica's handling of data and so on.
Right.
You know, at the underlying level, we have some sort of traditional databases. We've got a lot of MySQL databases and a bunch of other kinds of things. But that's sort of the underpinning of what we're doing. And then sort of above that is what we use the Mathematica database link,
yeah,
and then build up from that.
Have you, in your own use of it, seen any results that surprised you? Any insights?
Oh, hell yes. I mean, all the time. I mean, basically every domain we put in and, you know, I'm trying to figure out how it should all work and so on and so on. You know, I'll be typing stuff in and I will always be surprised. I mean, one particular area is just fun. It's, looking at people's names, like first names and so on. I had no idea how much structure there was in the popularity of a name as a function of time. And here's a fun thing that I just was really surprised by. You know, given, you know, you can know, like, from birth records, you can know, you know, how many people named, Stephen or something were born in each year for the last 100 years or so. But then you can use mortality data to figure out, so just how many will be surviving at this time and so on. And from that, you can get kind of a distribution of what the expected ages of people will be. And it's really bizarre because an awful lot of people, particularly with slightly more unusual names, you can basically predict from their name roughly how old they are. That
wow.
really surprised me. I was not expecting that. I just didn't realize there was that that kind of quantitativeness in that area. But that's just one tiny example. I mean, I'm continually surprised by I've just never seen a lot of this. At some level the data exists because after all we're getting it from somewhere. But the issue is to what extent can we get when you actually see it presented in kind of a clear, you know, graphical or whatever way, I'm often really struck by, you know, you see a lot of things that you just would never have never noticed any other way.
That must be gratifying. I mean, in a way that proves that this is meaningful.
I think so, to me at least. I mean, I've said to use it all the time.
Yeah. How, you know, I think one problem, of course, is that people are going to say, well, it's Google, and it's not. It's not a search engine.
No. I mean, it's a really different idea. I mean,
And it's never existed before, so it's difficult to explain to people.
Right, right. Well, I mean, the way that I view it as, you know, you have a specific question. It's something you might ask an expert, a scientist, an engineer, a medical person, something like that. And it's a specific question, and it's a question you can ask without having a whole essay to describe the question. Then that's something that's a serious candidate for Wolfram Alpha to do something with. And I think what will actually happen in practice is people will kind of they'll come up with particular patterns of questions that come up in their lives for whatever reason, whether it's things to do with dates or whether it's things to do with, computing tensile strength of beams or whether it's to do with, historical weather or, who knows what. And they'll sort of remember these are patterns of things that I can readily do in Wolfram Alpha. Just like, with search and with the web, we remember there are particular kinds of things. Like you can look up a person's name. That's things people do. Or, I remember the first time, it was probably years ago, when I realized that, when I saw some obscure error message from my computer, that I could type in a fragment of that error message, and that would be a useful thing to do.
Right.
I'm just slow, but I hadn't sort of realized immediately that that was a thing I could do. And I remember, there was a definite moment when I realized, yes, it's the thing that's going to work. But, the difference, in a sense, between what's happening in the web and web search and so on is there's kind of, you know, if somebody already asked a question and they wrote down the answer explicitly on the web, you know, somebody else's question that sort of they gave an explicit form of the answer somewhere on the web, then you can go search for it with a search engine.
Right.
And a search engine will then give you a bunch of links that say, okay, go read this page and that page and the other page to learn about the the answer that was given here. What we're trying to do is to say, you know, given the sort of corpus of knowledge that's been accumulated by our civilization, is there a way to compute the answer to some specific question that you immediately, you know, that you yourself have? And if we can compute the answer, let's generate a report that shows what the answer is. We're not saying, you know, here's a bunch of links to pages where people have written about this answer, but sort of just here's the answer, you know, hopefully presented in a clear way to the specific question that you have. So that's kind of the thing we're doing. And, you know, I think what will happen is that people will evolve from, you know, I was looking just yesterday, and today, I was looking at the query stream for Wolfram Alpha. And, yeah, there are a bunch of kind of search engine-like queries for which Wolfram Alpha is not especially suitable. But then there are starting to be, and I suspect this is going to develop even over the next few days and a week, there are starting to be these very specific, very sort of computational kinds of questions coming in that are really, you know, that's something Wolfram Alpha can do, and you're not going to do that by just sort of searching the web. And I suspect that, you know, as people kind of get used to these kind of patterns of usage, that we'll see this sort of increasing divergence between what people expect to type into Wolfram Alpha and what they've become conditioned to type into a search engine, for example.
Right. We're out of time, but I want to ask one last question. You kind of touched on this, but what are your hopes for Wolfram Alpha in the future, a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now?
Well, so, I mean, our big goal is sort of to see how much of the knowledge that's been accumulated in the world can really be made computable, can really be set up in such a way that anybody anywhere can just sort of type in a question and get a report of their answer produced. I think that the... you know, that's a big project, and we're sort of, I'm trying to sort of ramp up the effort. We're trying to figure out, you know, the right kind of ways to build a sort of appropriate business ecosystem around it so that we can ramp up this effort and set it up and, you know, get the, we've had just tremendous amounts of help and input from lots of experts and lots of people interested in lots of different fields, you know, figuring out how to sort of structure that that kind of network of that sort of community around the system, and then there are also much more kind of yet different intellectual ideas being able to sort of invent on the fly by searching the computational universe, these kinds of things. So that I think that my objective is sort of to get the existing corpus of human knowledge kind of committed to this computational form, and then to sort of automate the process of discovering, you know, fundamentally new kinds of knowledge using these kinds of approaches to science and so on. So that's the modest project.
I can't wait. It sounds amazing.
Thanks.
Stephen, thank you so much for taking some time and explaining this. I really, really appreciate it.
Okay. Good question. Thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you. Take care.
This is amazing.
Yeah. Round the horn.